This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Listeners, to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys as we celebrate Wolverine Month here at Place to Be Nation Pop. I am Greg Phillips. With me in our Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada studios, as always, you know him as the Sinister Minister, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
I don't think anybody knows me as that. Besides, isn't that nickname taken?
I have it on good authority, Nick, that you spent 1 year approximately in Extreme Championship Wrestling as the manager of Tajiri. Is that or is that not correct?
That is not correct. What would I be a minister of?
Sinisterism, apparently.
I'm not very sinister. I'm too lazy to be sinister.
Perhaps if you were the cynical minister.
That's a different, you know, that's a different topic altogether. Then I could get behind that. I could definitely get behind that, especially if it involved managing Abdullah the Butcher.
Legend wrestler. That's
Legend
correct.
Wrestler, yes.
I
heard a rumor that he was old in the knees, but that's just what I heard.
We are deep into the references. Literally, only Nick and I will get. But you, if you're listening to this show, which you clearly are, as I'm addressing you now, you are listening to the longest-running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
And you are joining us for Countdown. This is the podcast we do once a month, where Nick and I will, as this title indicates, do a lazy
count
cliche thing for the internet and count down our favorite, our least favorite, the best, the worst of the comic book world and related media. And since it is Wolverine Month here at the Hard Traveling Studios, we have decided to count down our top five episodes of the iconic 1990s X-Men the Animated Series. This was the show that introduced a generation of kids to Wolverine, myself included largely. I had read some X-Men comics before then, but this was really where I dug into Wolverine, and he became my favorite character. Cal Dodd, as he's known, was the voice of Wolverine, and he defined Wolverine for a generation until arguably Hugh Jackman only recently has usurped him as probably the most iconic take on the character of Wolverine. Nick, what was your first exposure? We've been over this in prior podcasts, but people may not have heard. What was your first exposure to X-Men, the animated series? I remember when it first came on, I watched the very first episode. You're a little bit younger than me. What was your experience with X-Men?
So I wasn't really aware that it was going on. You know, I was kind of young when it started. I think I was only like 4 at the time. But I remember probably about a year or so into the run, maybe 2 years, I can't really remember. They did the Pizza Hut promotion where it was some kind of gimmick where if you got a large pizza or 2 large pizzas or something, you would get an X-Men, the animated series videotape with the pizza. And I saw the commercial for it, and so I, like, you know, begged my parents, and I wound up getting both of the videotapes they offered, which I believe were just repackages of the first four episodes of the series, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Two on each videotape. And so I wore those out pretty heavy, and then I finally found the show, realized that the show was being broadcast on Fox, and, you know, never really did a chronological watching because there was no real way to do that, you know, back in those days. But I did, you know, start watching the show pretty regularly up through. I didn't watch it all the way to its conclusion. I kind of stopped at a certain point, but I do remember watching it for a couple of years after I discovered it.
Yeah, I started watching with the pilot episode, the Night of the Sentinels two-parter that was one of the tapes that you had because that was part of that Pizza Hut promotion.
Yep.
And I watched, to the best of my knowledge, every episode, every Saturday morning, until all the way up through the last storyline that I remember seeing. There were a few that I missed here and there due to football practice and things like that. But the last episodes that I remember seeing were the what was the name? It was the Apocalypse, like, four or five parter that ended the fourth season.
Yep.
Or came close to ending the fourth season. I don't know if it actually did or not. But
which is weird, because Apocalypse was around since the first season, so you would have thought that they would have blown that off at some point.
And they didn't. They showed remarkable patience in that he kidnapped all the telepaths and telekinetics that had been introduced on the show, and some that hadn't, and basically took them out of the time stream in an attempt to reshape reality in his image. And that's the last episode I remember. So I don't really know that I watched any of the fifth season episodes until later on when I was maybe in college, and I watched a few of them, which had a really different animation style and just changed up entirely. I take that back. I do remember watching the series finale. I think that was an appointment television kind of thing for me. I think I read in a magazine that it was coming up or something. So I remember watching that. But yeah, it was an incredible show, and for those four seasons, I looked forward to X-Men as much as I did Batman. It, just totally different shows, going for different things, but I really looked forward every Saturday morning to see this show because it was the first cartoon that I'm aware of in America that ever really had continuity like that, where every episode truly bled into each subsequent episode. Everything that happened had some impact on something later on, and to see it tied together the way that the comic books were tied together, in some ways, it was the closest to a comic book that a show had been to that point.
Agreed.
And yes, it did face its restrictions with regards to censorship, not being allowed to say certain words, not including the word kill, which they came up with a lot of creative ways to replace the word kill on the show, and violence restrictions, which hampered what they could do, but they worked around it really brilliantly, and they focused on interesting character interactions, and really good plots, interesting plots that really made up for some of the difficulties in what they could do as far as the action scenes. So, great show, iconic show, still my favorite X-Men show, although some have definitely given it a run for its money with regards to Wolverine and the X-Men in particular. But, Nick, before we get into our countdown, I'm assuming you have – or actually, I know you have an affinity for this show as well.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, it was one that I – like I said, I really enjoyed as a kid. Now, granted, that kind of shows me our different experiences because I don't even remember – ever watching the show on Saturday morning. By the time I was watching, they were re-airing in syndication on the, if you remember, the Friday or the weekday afternoon after school block that was like Fox Kids or whatever, and they were taking them and kind of doing them daily at that point. So I remember watching that and Power Rangers and Batman and a bunch of other stuff that way, not really doing the Saturday morning block anymore. So just a different experience with watching the show. But yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, obviously, like I said, being a big fan as I was a kid, and then when we were in college, Greg, or maybe you had just left Troy at the time, I remember the DVD releases and how cool it was at the time, because, you know, Netflix was kind of a fledgling thing. The idea of internet streaming wasn't really, you know, fully fledged out at that point. You could find the random episode here and there on YouTube or something like that, but I do remember being very excited for those DVD releases and, like, going to Walmart and picking those up on their release day for the first two volumes whenever they drop. So, and really being pleasantly surprised at, you know, when I went back and re-explored them. I think a lot of things from our childhood, you know, as is wont to happen, often don't hold up in hindsight. And going back and watching X-Men and rewatching a little bit in the last couple weeks to prepare for this podcast, it's almost been like I enjoyed X-Men on one level when I was a kid, and it's almost like there's this whole other level for it to be enjoyed at on, because, I mean, we give a lot of credit to Batman the Animated Series, and deservedly so, for being a darker show than had ever really been attempted for children at that point, but rewatching some X-Men recently, it's amazing how much, I won't say dark, but like mature and adult-themed content, like heady stuff, intricate subplots, political, like, you know, implications of things that they were able to fit into this show, and they didn't dumb it down for kids. I mean, obviously it wasn't like, you know, debating in-depth, like, foreign policy or anything like that, but it was giving these kids, like, you know, topical morality plays at on a level that hadn't really been attempted before, and I was highly impressed by the episodes I have revisited in my later years.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that unifies the entries on my list, with maybe one or two exceptions, is there's a lot of that. I tend to flock to the. I'll be honest, I only had a chance to rewatch two episodes before putting my list together. Finally,
you only got me beat by, like, I think I watched maybe 10 or 12. I watched like the first 6 episodes a couple weeks ago, and then I watched like 5 or 6 more today before the podcast. So don't feel too bad.
So I'm going off of memory, and in my memory, the episodes, with some exceptions, there are some of the just fun, crazy episodes that stand out that didn't make my list, like Mojo Vision and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the ones that stand out the most are the ones that made me think when I was a kid, or the ones that kind of helped shape me and expose me to different thought processes and metaphors that I didn't realize even were metaphors at the time.
Right.
That I can look back on now and understand. A lot of the great – and a lot of these episodes were just based on the great ideas that Chris Claremont and John Byrne had years earlier and other
Absolutely.
Creators as well. Absolutely. But Claremont being the unifying factor. So,
and you know,
it's just such a great show.
It really is, and it's just remarkable the things they were – you know, you and I have talked before about our number one complaint with kids' television today is that – pretty much every show we've come across treats the audience, the children's audience today, as if they're stupid by peppering in them with constant, like, you know, Family Guy-style cutaways on something like Teen Titans Go, or just kind of speaking to the lowest common denominator, and this is a show that doesn't do that. This is a show that gives kids credit for being intelligent and thinks and figures they'll catch on, they'll figure it out as it's going along, because, I mean, as we'll discuss here in a little bit, at one point in one of the episodes I'm going to talk about, there are, you know, no less than 5 or 6 different subplots all being juggled at once, and it never, you know, the writers never sought to dumb it down for the kids. They trusted their audience and their fan base to follow along, and as a result, you have a legion of children who grew up rabidly adoring the show. So, big props to the creators of this one.
Absolutely, and with all that being said, let's get started with our countdown. At my number 5 episode.
Yep.
And I am – and oh, actually, before we do this, we should mention that we are going by our own made-up rule that we've done in previous countdowns of Batman and Justice League episodes,
mm-hmm.
which is that we are counting multi-parters as one episode.
That's right.
Yes, it's a cheat, but that means we are counting 2-parters, 3-, 4-, and 5-parters as one episode if they have the same title.
Yes.
So,
if it specifically says part 1, part 2, part 3, part 4, etc. in the title, then yes, we are counting them as one episode.
So, yeah. So if you don't like that, too bad. We did it. If you want us to narrow it down, send us a tweet, send us a Facebook message, and we'll do our best to narrow it down to single episodes for you. But this is what we got for now. So, I'm going to get it started with a season 2 episode, and this is a 2-parter, appropriately enough, titled Till Death Do Us Part. This is an episode that had been teased for quite a while. This was the first real appearance of – not the first appearance, the first real look that we get at Mr. Sinister, and – he had been watching. We learned earlier that he had been watching the Summers family for some time, and Scott and Jean kick off this episode by getting married, much to Wolverine's chagrin. But this episode centers on Sinister putting this plan in place to get Xavier out of the way and to lure Scott and Jean to an island that he has set up where he plans to take them for sinister purposes. And in the first part, you don't actually see Sinister. You don't find out until the end that he's monitoring them. You get a little bit with Grade and Creed and the Friends of Humanity. You get the Scott and Jean wedding itself. And importantly, you get the return of a major character. This was a big deal because the character of Morph was killed off in the very first episode of X-Men. And his death sort of loomed large over the team and everything that happened after that as a sign of loss and an indication that this show was different and that people were in danger. Characters they established in the first episode could be taken off the board. So here, Morph returns as a twisted, villainous version of himself. And I remember just being shocked when I was a kid. Like, when Morph showed up, I remember...
complete with a redesigned look that is creepy and off-putting as hell.
Yes. With the big black circles around his eyes and just looking generally pale, strung out.
Yeah, pale skin. Yeah, very much looking strung out. That's a good point. Good way to put it.
And we learn that he's developed kind of a split personality where the old Morph is still in there, but he's also been warped by Mr. Sinister into being this almost evil personality that wants revenge on his teammates for leaving him for dead. He's clearly been manipulated by Sinister. And the reason that this episode stands out in my memory, the Scott, Jean, and Wolverine dynamic, I know a lot of people find that love triangle cheesy or whatever. I was sucked into that love triangle as a kid. I was 100% invested. I was Team Wolverine all the way. And so I felt for Logan as he was having to watch the girl he was in love with get married to his teammate. You know, that was tough for him. And as the episode plays out, you see him kind of put together that they're in danger. And you get to see Sinister's henchmen, the Nasty Boys, of course referring to Jerry Sags and Brian Knobbs, get into a knockdown.
And they take Wolverine to Pity City, of course.
That's right. They get into a knockdown, drag-out fight with the X-Men. But in all seriousness, the fight between Sinister's Nasty Boys, which is a group of his mutates, I believe he calls them, against...
do his mutates have anything to do with the mutates that were under the employ of our old friend, the High Evolutionary?
You know, I don't know. You would think that the High Evolutionary would have better mutates, but you know,
he is the High Evolutionary.
I think Sinister might be classified as a low to medium level evolutionary. I'm not 100% sure about that.
Now, what about Counter Sinister? Does he play a role in this?
Counter Sinister is not a factor in this story, no. But Counter Sinister is actually remarkably similar to Mr. Sinister, except that he has purple skin and a white suit.
And Peter falls in love with him instantly upon meeting him.
Absolutely. Peter Parker and Counter Mr. Sinister, or is it Mr. Counter Sinister? The world may never know. They fall in love and get married on Counter Earth, but that's neither here nor there. Sinister's Nasty Boys have a great fight with the X-Men, and that's the main reason that this made it over everything else. This was one of the best fights in the early seasons. You get to see Ruckus and who are these other characters? I've forgotten their names, but I remember one of them named Ruckus. But you get to see them go to battle with the X-Men. They all pair off. You get a great dynamic with Rogue and Gambit in the episode. There's a character named Gorgeous George, which I appreciate as a wrestling fan, who tries to take out Gambit and is later taken out by Rogue. it's just a great, great battle, and it creates this really creepy vibe to Mr. Sinister that he's basically been spying on Gene and Scott in all their private moments, wink, wink, for quite some time, and basically just wants, we still really don't know what he wants to do with them. He's grabbed them, he's got them tied up, you know, he's going to use them for something, and is just morbidly obsessed with Scott Summers and the Summers family. And I just thought this was a great episode, and it stands out in my memory as having everything that I loved about the show. The over-the-top soap opera drama, the action, the menacing, vaguely defined villain, because again, Mr. Sinister's powers are completely vaguely defined at this point. We don't really know what he can do, what he can't do. We learn a little bit over the course of the episode. But yeah, really, really fun stuff.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, but for reasons that I don't want to, you know, I don't want to tell tales out of school, I will largely keep silent for now.
Oh.
But,
all right, well, let's get to your number five.
Moving on to my number five, and this is one I was able to rewatch here just today, and I mainly wanted to rewatch it because I remembered that it notably contained the debut of Lady Deathstrike, aka Yuriko, on this show, who has a romantic past with Wolverine, and I remember there being a lot of great emotional moments. What I did not remember, and the reason that I ultimately forced myself to put this on the list, is that it features the infamous scene where Xavier is rolling around at the beginning of the episode and randomly stops and clutches his head and screams, "Power! Incredible power!" and then proceeds to shriek like an 11-year-old girl.
I think Nick just killed himself trying to do the Xavier scream.
The power, incredible power, destroyed me. But no, in addition to that bit of hilarity, it also provides some key flashbacks to the character of Wolverine and an outstanding vocal performance from Cal Dodd, which could really be said for all of these episodes. But the ones where they dig a little deeper into Wolverine's backstory were always among my favorites, and this one certainly is here as well. It also provides, at the end of the episode, a tease for where the show is going next because it features the cliffhanger that officially announces that the Phoenix Saga is coming and kind of hints at the X-Men's foray into outer, more galactic and cosmic-focused adventures and stuff. So it really had a lot of stuff that I think longtime X-Men fans have been waiting for. And it had the debut of the Reavers as well, so just a lot of really good stuff. And so basically the plot revolves around the Lady Deathstrike and the Reavers have gone into the sewers of New York where the Morlocks live and have basically discovered this alien spacecraft that can only be opened by someone with adamantium. Deathstrike, can't open it because it's causing some sort of pain on her every time she touches it, but she knows Wolverine has a healing factor, and plus she wants to get revenge on him anyway for reasons that are revealed in the episode. And so they wind up luring he and Jubilee and Gambit down into the sewers by having the Morlocks send a distress call. They show up, and then you kind of get this big emotional showdown between Yuriko and Wolverine. And Cal Dodd, for all the bluster and all the menace he put into his voice in a lot of these episodes, really nails the emotional impact here that this is having on Logan. And it's a two-part episode that winds up forcing in this kind of alien creature known as a spirit hunter or something like that. And that aspect of the episode isn't the most interesting thing, but for that focus on that Deathstroke and Wolverine dynamic, and again, the vocal performance from Cal Dodd, that's what puts this one on my list.
Yes, this was a notable episode for me, both for the power, incredible power, of course. Also was on one of the X-Men VHSs that we used to rent in high school and college from Blockbuster. Our Blockbuster would have a few collected editions of the X-Men animated series, and this was one of them. This episode was on one of them. We would rent that and watch it, my friends and I, occasionally. And so this episode I remember very well. And it's interesting to me in hindsight how they pretty much combined Mariko Yoshida and Yuriko Lady Deathstrike into one character.
Right, which is an interesting take. I've never really seen that before, and so it kind of it stuck out to me.
Yeah, it was, and it worked in the context of the episode and the context of the show, really, because I don't know that the show would have had a chance to really do the Japan saga properly, given their restrictions and given
the
nature of that story.
Yeah, and they were so loaded down with love interest for Wolverine, you know, like between Jean and another character that we'll discuss, I think, here in a little bit, to add a fourth female character with a significant tie to Wolverine's past would have been a little weird.
Right. And in this case, it worked well. Lady Deathstrike was certainly a menacing villain. The Reavers were obnoxious villains and very very hateable villains.
Now, let me ask you this, Greg.
Great episode.
In the comics, were the Reavers always portrayed as Australian?
Yes, I believe that's the case.
Okay, I didn't know that. So, I'm not...
Yeah, because the Reavers, if I'm not mistaken, and Tim, if you're listening, you can probably correct me on this, or you might know it better because I wasn't yet reading when the Reavers first came along. But I believe they came along while the X-Men were based in Australia in the late 80s.
Ah, gotcha.
Which is where that comes in. So it was not a Pride of the X-Men situation.
Gotcha. I just know that I you know, in my rewatching of some episodes, I noticed there were a lot of Australian accents between the Reavers and, you know, true Aussie Pyro, which I popped big for today, hearing the voice again for the first time in a long time.
Love me some Pyro.
Yep.
On to my number four. And you hinted at this just a moment ago. That other love interest was Silver Fox. And she is seen prominently in my number four episode, which, by the way, folks, is the greatest title ever for X-Men, the animated series.
Yes.
The title of the episode, in a nod to Steven Soderbergh, Weapon X Lies in Videotape. Big pop for that title.
And it also describes the events of the episode pretty well as well.
Yes, to a T, in fact.
Yeah.
Because this is an episode that, as Nick pointed out a few minutes ago, delves into Wolverine's past, which is one of the staples of what were, to me, some of the most compelling episodes of the animated series, when you see Wolverine get glimpses into his mysterious and tortured past, because it gave Cal Dodd a chance to really dig in and show his depth and his range and really show us the tortured side of Wolverine as opposed to kind of the smart-ass side that we get a lot, which is great too. But in these cases, it always brought out these special emotions from him. And then in addition to that, these episodes also crafted and built upon the mystery of Logan that made him so cool when you're a kid. We talked just last week about how I had misgivings about the Wolverine origin book, because I always thought that keeping that air of mystery about Logan was the right thing to do. And episodes like this prove it, in my opinion, because what makes this episode work is that there are revelations going on in multiple ways. You, as a reader, are finding out about the history of Logan, the things that you didn't know. Logan is finding out things about his past that he doesn't know. Beast is there with him as an outside observer, and you're seeing Sabretooth, Wolverine's archenemy, have to work alongside him, which is a really interesting thing to happen. Along the way, you meet these crazy characters, Maverick and Silver Fox. Maverick, by the way, one of the most 90s characters ever. In a giant Rob Liefeld-like outfit, but I love him nonetheless. Just very, very bizarre. And so you see all of these weird mismatch of mysterious characters together, and you find out they have a shared past. And that, to me as a kid, was really cool. Basically what the episode is about is that Wolverine's been having these nightmares for some unspecified amount of time, really for quite a while. He doesn't know where he comes from necessarily. He only remembers bits and pieces of his past. And he's been having these flashbacks to a scene in a cabin with a woman and Sabretooth being there and attacking the woman. Not unlike what we saw, by the way, in X-Men Origins Wolverine last week. essentially he gets a postcard that seems to be from Silver Fox, the woman in the cabin, with degrees on the back, longitude and latitude. He thinks, he's not sure who sent it, because he thinks she's dead, and he shows up to the old Weapon X facility in Canada, where the map took him, essentially, only to discover he's been tailed by Beast, and Sabretooth is also there. And then they discover that Silver Fox and Maverick are still alive and have lured them there to help them unlock the secrets of Weapon X and their shared past. We find out about implanted memories, false emotions, the torture that Wolverine in particular went through, but the other members of what was known as Team X at the time went through as well. You find out that for all their differences, that Wolverine and Sabretooth's animosity has largely been manufactured by an outside party. Mm-hmm. Things that never happened were made to happen. But we also learn, tragically, at the end of the episode, that one of the memories that Silver Fox has convinced herself was fake, which is Wolverine and Silver Fox's time together. As we learn at the very end of the episode, we see the carving in the tree, Logan loves Silver Fox. So we find out at the end that it was real, and Logan is still holding on to that. So there's just a lot. There's a lot going on in this episode, admittedly, but it delves into his past in such a compelling way. The way that they animated the Weapon X flashbacks were tremendous, and this version of Dr. Cornelius is what I wanted out of the X-Men Origins movie, because that's how creepy he's supposed to be. He's obnoxious. He's slimy. He's cold and distant. He comes off like just an evil human being. And you just want, Sabretooth at one point says, why don't we track him down and make him suffer or something like that. And you really want him to. You want them to find this guy and make him suffer. Of course, they do not. But it's just a tremendous episode from top to bottom. And in my opinion, one of the five greatest episodes in X-Men history.
I agree with completely with everything you said, and once more, I will have to withhold comment until for a little bit. But moving on to my number four, you know, we you and I both, Greg, have talked about it to this point in the podcast, how these Wolverine-focused episodes tend to be among our favorites. Well, I'm going to go to a different character here, and I'm going to go to an episode that introduced another beloved X-Man, and I'm going with the episode Nightcrawler as my number four, because this is the episode that introduced everybody's favorite furry blue mutant, but did it in a really cool way by having, you know, one of those classic X-Men on vacation type stories. And basically Wolverine on vacation gets bored and hears that about this reported demon that is living in a monastery or a castle, I can't remember which one, near to this town. And he goes to investigate and winds up, you know, encountering Nightcrawler. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and the episode essentially ends with the townspeople seeking to basically do the classic coming after him with pitchforks and torches thing, and Wolverine helps him to escape and convinces him to go off and, you know, become an ally of the X-Men. But really, the reason this lands on my list is it's a really cool exploration of the dynamic between Nightcrawler and Wolverine. You know, Wolverine being someone who has almost been tortured by violence over his entire life, no matter how far he tries to get away from a violent existence, he keeps getting sucked back in. And he finds somebody who is attempting to be nonviolent in Nightcrawler an interesting counterpoint. It's a way of life he can't really understand, and it forces Logan to question something that is certainly a mature topic. It forces Logan to question his faith and the role that faith plays in the world. And normally I'm not someone who advocates for religious themed episodes or, you know, faith themed episodes, because I don't think that many writers can do them very subtly, but I thought this was pretty much expertly handled by the writing team of X-Men the Animated Series. I thought they did a great job of kind of illustrating how Nightcrawler uses that faith to find inner peace. And at the end of the episode, Wolverine kind of makes a decision, you know, as it relates to his faith, that I thought was a very interesting take for Wolverine, and not something I'm not really familiar with from the comics. So, you know, and plus it was just great to see Nightcrawler on the screen for the first time. I mean, the teleportation effects are always one of the coolest little animation bits from the show, And they nail him. Absolutely nail him. And, again, you know, we give shout-outs to Cal Dodds all the time, but what about the guy who voices Nightcrawler in these episodes? I thought he was outstanding as well. One of the better voice actors on the show, even if his German accent is admittedly a little, you know, a little over the top. But it's something that I thoroughly enjoyed nonetheless. Apparently that voice actor's name is Adrian Howe, as Kurt Wagner. So, loved the hell out of this episode. Really cool to get to see Nightcrawler on screen for the first time.
Hey, totally agree. Great points all around, and I can't say any more than that at the moment, because I plan on revisiting that.
Awesome.
But let me move on to my number three episode, which, oddly enough, is all much like Weapon X, Lies, and Videotape, is a season four episode, and it is actually the episode that directly follows Weapon X, Lies, and Videotape, at least in the production order that they have on Hulu, which is how I revisited this episode. It's a two-parter about what would happen if someone went back in time and killed Professor Xavier, a storyline that we've seen play out in the comics before. This episode is called One Man's Worth, and it's almost an It's a Wonderful Life type deal where, in some ways, that we've seen play out in the comics where the characters of, bear with me, people that are listening that have never read the X-Men, Fitzroy and Nimrod go back to the 1950s.
I thought Nimrod was a sentinel of some sort.
Nimrod is a sentinel. Yes.
Okay.
Nimrod is an advanced sentinel that is sent by Master Mold to accompany Fitzroy from the far. It's going to make you go cross-eyed, but X-Men: The Animated Series specialized in time travel episodes, and it got increasingly confusing in the how it all tied together. But basically, in the future that Bishop is from, and his sister Shard, Master Mold, the lead sentinel, has evolved intelligence to the point where he and the Sentinels control all life, basically, and have essentially almost eradicated mutant kind, but the mutants are still revolting. And so he sends Fitzroy, who's a mutant that is on his side, back with Nimrod to the 1950s to assassinate Charles Xavier, with the thought process that when that happens, the X-Men will never come to be, and the mutants will fall easily. And it works. They send him back in time. They assassinate Xavier. And the X-Men, instead of coming to be the X-Men as we know them, are basically freedom fighters working with Magneto to try and overthrow the Sentinels and losing the battle, essentially, in the present day. So, to counteract this, our old friend Forge, friend of the podcast Forge, helps Bishop and Shard head back to what is present-day Westchester to go to the X-Mansion and see what things have changed. And there they encounter Wolverine and Storm, who are much different than the Wolverine and Storm that we know. They are freedom fighters working with Magneto. They are Wolverine's got a big 5 o'clock shadow going on, and he and Storm are lovers. Storm rocking the Mohawk look, I believe. And they're lovers, and they're fighting against these Sentinels, trying to survive, basically. Well, Bishop and Shard show up and explain the situation and basically recruit them to go back with them to help stop Nimrod and Fitzroy, Trevor Fitzroy, that is. And along the way, without giving away too much about the episode, in case you guys want to go check it out, it just shows you that without Charles Xavier, the whole dynamic changes. And it's really good reminder of why Xavier is important, because I think we've kind of been conditioned by his characterization in the comics over the years that Xavier's almost become this villainous figure of sorts, this almost domineering,
a jackass in every sense of the word.
Jackass, like, yeah.
So overbearing and condescending in many ways, to where so convinced of his own correctness at all times. Like, no one can ever have the moral high ground with Charles Xavier.
Right, and it feels like the cartoon was, much like the movies, a glimpse back to the Charles Xavier, perhaps the way that Stan Lee envisioned him as the moral compass and leader of the X-Men. And when we meet Charles in college, because basically they go back to the 1950s when Charles Xavier's in college, and they Bishop Shard and the alternate versions of Wolverine and Storm go back to try and save him from assassination, much like the Terminator. It's essentially the X-Men take on the Terminator, and it's really well done. There's this great, heartbreaking scene before they go back in time, after they've heard the story from Bishop and Shard, and Storm says, okay, we'll help you. Wolverine stops her, and she says, no, because they've just been told by Bishop that if they go back in time and stop this from happening, yes, the Sentinels won't overthrow them in 1993 or whatever it is, but Wolverine and Storm will be teammates, but they won't be lovers, and they won't have their history together. And Wolverine says, I can't lose you. I can't lose what we have. And Storm says, Logan, would you be willing to sacrifice the entire world just to save our love? And he says, he says something to the effect of, you bet I would, in a heartbeat. And it was a really, like, affecting scene, and the delivery from Cal Dodd was wonderful. And then ultimately, of course, Storm convinces Wolverine that it's the right thing to do, and so they go back, and they help Bishop and Shard stop this from happening. And long story short, obviously, everything ends up okay. They prevent it from happening. They foil Master Mold's plan. But the point of the episode is never that they're going to fail at this. You never think they're actually going to fail to save Xavier. The point of the episode is showing you how important Xavier is, and along the way, investing you in these alternate versions of Wolverine and Storm that, quite frankly, I had never thought of them as a couple before. But after that episode, I was like, man, I'd love to see more of these two different but similar versions of these two characters. So, really great episode.
Hadn't that coupling been done in the comics at various points?
I think it might have. Maybe in Days of Future Past, I'm not sure. But it's been done in the comics, I think, once or twice. But I had never read it. You have to understand, I was reading 90s X-Men, and that was not even close to a thing. When I was reading it, Storm, I believe, was still dating Forge, which was a unique coupling. And Wolverine was, you know, doing his pining over Jean thing. So it was a really cool thing to see, and the voice actors and actresses in the episode did a great job. And it was a chance to see, once again, Charles try to read someone's mind and suffer pain as a result of it. So just overall, I have to say it was a great episode. I actually rewatched it before doing this podcast and very much enjoyed it.
Outstanding. Moving on to my number three, it's one that Greg has already talked about a little bit. So at number three, I'm going with Weapon X, Lies, and Videotape. And obviously, you know, Greg did a great job of outlining all the reasons why this is one of the series' five greatest episodes, mainly for the Wolverine stuff. I mean, just the emotion of this show, when it's at its best, can really tug at the emotional heartstrings, unlike just about any, you know, children's television show I've ever seen in my life. It is so good at going there when it wants to go there. And yes, Cal Dodd is outstanding, and yes, all the Wolverine stuff is outstanding, but, you know, since Greg has already kind of given you a blow-by-blow of the episode, let's throw a little shout-out to an underrated aspect of the episode, I think, and that's the Sabretooth stuff. Getting to see Sabretooth fighting alongside Wolverine for a common goal was something that felt like the show had been building to for a long time, while still managing to maintain that sense of tension. And yes, while it's heartbreaking at the end when it's revealed that Logan's memory of his relationship with Silver Fox was real, what about what is revealed that potentially wasn't real for Sabretooth? In that it is hinted at in this episode that Sabretooth's overly aggressive nature and overly aggressive attitude, and basically the reason why he is who he is because of falsely implanted memories of a of an abusive childhood that potentially never happened.
Yep.
And the idea of that is so heartbreaking in so many ways that it just adds this whole really other layer to the villainy of Dr. Cornelius.
Yeah, the in particular the scene where Sabretooth breaks down crying, and you actually see Wolverine almost have a moment of pity as he's watching Sabretooth break down crying and saying,
right.
"Please don't do it, Daddy. Please don't do it," or something to that effect. Really affecting scene.
I mean, and just again, you know, do we know of another show that could have gotten away with dealing with child abuse? Like, I understand that they had to face some censorship from Fox, and there were certain things they weren't allowed to get away with. But they really were able to tackle some things that no other show of its kind has been able to tackle was able to tackle before or since. Honestly, truly impressive stuff here from the writing team.
Oh, 100% agree with you on that. I mentioned how much I love that episode. Really thought it held up well. And granted, a lot of this is coming from my Wolverine bias.
Right.
I have a lot of Wolverine episodes on my list, but I think there is something to be said for why Wolverine is my favorite character, and that ties into how well he was portrayed on this show. It's a huge, undeniably a huge part of why I love this character so much. So, big fan of that one as well. On to my number two episode of all time from X-Men, and this is a cheat. I'll be the first to admit it. We set you up for this at the beginning of the episode. I am including as one episode the entire Dark Phoenix saga. This, of course, followed the Phoenix saga, which was more of a space epic involving the Shi'ar Empire and the Starjammers.
And then I think there was a one-episode kind of interlude. It was like you did the five-part Phoenix saga, and then there was like only one or two episodes, and then you were right into the Dark Phoenix saga right after that. So not a ton of lag time between the two Phoenix sagas.
Yes. And that was more of a space, like I said, a space deal. And it was followed by the Dark Phoenix saga, which was much more psychological in nature. It followed the, of course, the attempts of the Hellfire Club, known as the Inner Circle here, to kind of corrupt Jean Grey and to take advantage of this overwhelming power that was inside her, the Phoenix Force, which we learned about earlier, of course, in the Phoenix Saga. She's manipulated by Jason Wingard, this comes right out of the comics, manipulated by Jason Wingard and the other members of the Inner Circle. And over the course of this, let me see, what was this? This was a four-parter, the Dark Phoenix Saga. You were introduced to the Hellfire Club, or the version of the Hellfire Club that you see here. I don't think they're actually called the Hellfire Club. But you meet the Inner Circle, and these creepy, as Todd and Tim recently described, I would go listen to Todd Weber's Conversation Comics with Tim Capel. They've already gone over the building blocks to the Dark Phoenix saga. They're going over that right now in that series. And this is a little bit abbreviated version of that, where you see Jean get manipulated and that incredible power perverted and turned over to the side of the Hellfire Club to use against the X-Men and to use for their own purposes, to the point where Jason Wingard uses his mental manipulation skills, his mastermind skills, if you will, to convince Jean that she's in love with him. And actually she ends up falling in love with Jason Wingard, being positioned to be the new queen of the Hellfire Club, or the Inner Circle, much to Cyclops' chagrin, obviously. But the real reason that this makes my list is just how well it captured these iconic moments from the comics, because so much of this was lifted straight from the page. Primarily, I'm thinking about the knockdown, drag-out fight, I believe it was in episode 3, of this four-parter between the X-Men and the Hellfire Club that includes the iconic scene of Wolverine getting knocked down into the sewers, coming back up. Great usage of mutant powers as we see the Hellfire Club with their strange abilities. The guy that absorbs Cyclops' optic blasts and uses it for physical strength. You see these mutants doing battle in such a memorable fashion. And then, of course, there is the tragic ending with Jean losing control of herself. And, just a great, great episode, series of episodes, honestly. But I'll count it as one. I think it represents everything great about the show, because you have the entire team involved, which some of our episodes we've mentioned to this point have not had the entire team involved. This had the entire team involved. This had an introduction to an iconic group of villains. This was the first time I'd ever encountered these villains when I was a kid, and they really introduced me to the concept of what I would later know to be the Hellfire Club perfectly. Wrapped up the loose threads from the Phoenix Saga, and put end to my, admittedly, to my Schadenfreude self, if that's the way you pronounce that. It put Cyclops through the emotional ringer, so that was good for me as a kid. But no, in all seriousness, I think that this is the episode that I would show people if they want to know what the X-Men are all about as far as this show goes. I would show them the Dark Phoenix Saga, show them the variety that it's that is possible here, where you can emphasize the team dynamic so well, and how they got you to invest in this storyline of can Jean break away from the Hellfire Club, and it doesn't end in the tidiest of manners either. So really enjoyed this one. I don't know if this one made your list, Nick, but I stand by it.
No, I mean, it very clearly would make most people's list. It didn't make mine just because of it still had a little bit of that cosmic influence thrown in there, which has never been my favorite aspect of the X-Men, but I understand why it made yours, and it's certainly probably the most famous, or one of the most famous, adapted storylines that the show did, in terms of pretty directly taking some of the events of the comics and, trying to put their own little spin on them. But anyway, moving on to my number two, my number two episode, and it's one that you go back real early. I mentioned those Pizza Hut videotapes, and for me, I'm going to go with Enter Magneto as my number two episode of all time for a variety of reasons. As the title states, it's the introduction of Magneto to the show. Magneto, who is unquestionably the premier X-Men villain, it introduces him. You get the classic World War II backstory here in this episode. You get kind of a little bit of information on his relationship with Charles Xavier, and kind of you also get a classic, or a very good closing action scene, a climactic action scene where Magneto is preparing to launch nuclear missiles at strategic targets across the world, and the X-Men kind of come together to stop him, and it's the first real display of Magneto's true power. And you also get one of the classic images from the comics of Xavier inside Magneto's head, forcing him to relive hated aspects of his life. But the real reason this makes my list is the secondary plot that revolves around Beast, who has been incarcerated after the events of the Night of the Sentinels. When the X-Men were trying to steal the mutant registry, or shut down the National Mutant Registry, and he's been incarcerated, and you have Magneto coming to him early on and offering to give him his freedom, and Beast is essentially refusing, saying that he wants to go through the proper channels and prove a point that mutants are human, and they shouldn't be feared. They should just be treated as equals. And so you get this courtroom scene of Beast on trial, and during the courtroom scene, we are introduced to Sabretooth for the first time there, who sees Beast being abused by guards and stands up and makes a scene. And the X-Men, attempt to intervene before Sabretooth is injured. And you have Wolverine there who refuses to intervene on Sabretooth's behalf, says he knows him and you can't trust anything he does. And there's so much in this episode, mm-hmm. that very early on, it's clear that, like I've said before, there's no way any other show could have gotten away with some of this stuff. Consider that in this episode, you have the character of Beast reading George Orwell's Animal Farm. You have him quoting Shakespeare and Crime and Punishment when on trial. You have who is supposed to be, if not the main character of your show, one of the main characters of your show, and a heroic character in Wolverine, refusing to take action to save the life of another. You've got the entire debate about pacifism versus aggression in terms of attempting to enact social change. And there's just so much in this episode that I feel like would never be attempted today by a show like this, would never be attempted today by a superhero animated show aimed at kids. And it's just so incredible how the creators of this show knew so early on what they could do with the format and what kind of, you know, stories it was going to allow them to tell. And sure, there are probably better episodes than this one. It's probably a little high on my list, probably a little high for most people, but I kind of think it's the perfect example of what this show can do when it's at its best and what it can do that other shows just couldn't.
No, you bring up a lot of great points. I was going to say that is an awesome explanation for it, because you get to see that this show, that the X-Men are different. You see what makes them different from what maybe you'll see from Spider-Man or Batman or Spider-Man, Batman, or Superman would never take the action that Wolverine takes, which is inaction.
Yes.
They would never do that. And it makes him different. And it makes Beast different, that he's willing to stay incarcerated because it's the right thing to do. And because he's intellectual. He's thinking five steps ahead of the game. And you see Magneto, who is a villain, but who has a reason for his villainy, which is not like the Joker on Batman, who was cackling and, you know, just wanted to cause trouble, basically. Magneto's not doing this to cause trouble. Magneto's doing this because he feels like he's in the right. You're instantly establishing that the X-Men is almost the ultimate human study, even though it's about mutants, because it's about how things aren't as black and white as we would always like them to be. And exploring that in the concept of a superhero show is really interesting.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, Cal Dodd is outstanding, but I would say, for my money anyway, when I'm reading an X-Men comic to this day, I hear Cal Dodd as Wolverine, but the other voice from this series that has never really been surpassed, in my opinion, is the voice actor George Buzza as the voice of Beast, a.k.a. Hank McCoy. Still hear this version of Beast every time I read anything that has Beast in it, even if it's Cat Beast. There is something about, like, this particular vocal portrayal of Hank McCoy that just works for me. And even Kelsey Grammer, who I would have thought would have been, like, the perfect, like, live-action version of that, to me, it still couldn't hold up to what this guy was able to do with the character. Just an outstanding vocal performance throughout the entire series from George Buzza.
Completely agreed. He was outstanding. I would also throw in the voice actor for Gambit. I don't know his name. I would also throw in the voice actress for Rogue and for Storm. Mm-hmm. And I would also throw in whoever did the voice of Apocalypse, because I still hear that booming melodramatic voice every time I read Apocalypse. Just wanted to give some shouts out to some of the iconic voice actors on this show. But let's move on to my number one, and Nick's already described the episode for you. My number one, for very personal reasons, is Nightcrawler. This is the episode that stands out the most in my mind. It's the one that I remember affecting me the most. It's an episode that made me think, an episode that exposed bigotry to me, an episode that made me think about my own faith for maybe the first time in my life, to really sit down and think about it in a different way. I'm not going to get all spiritual mumbo jumbo on you guys with all this stuff, but for someone who came from a religious household, and I do consider myself to be religious in my own way, it was really cool to see it tackled in a thoughtful way, in a way that wasn't condescending in a way that didn't make it an easy solution for anybody involved. We see a character in Kurt Wagner, Nightcrawler, that in many ways, much like his comic book counterpart, is the most likable of the X-Men that we've encountered on the show to this point. He's a character who you just cannot help but like, because in the face of overwhelming prejudice, being more visually susceptible to prejudice than any of the others, even Beast, because Beast just looks like a wild animal. Nightcrawler literally looks like a demon. And he has to face the worst in humanity, and yet he still sees the best in humanity and is a pacifist and has this unbreakable will that, much to my surprise as a kid and much to the character it's himself's surprise, ends up wearing off on Wolverine and his cynicism. That is so inspirational even today. I rewatched this episode maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and it had the same impact on me to see this grizzled, cynical Wolverine at the end of the episode on his knees asking for forgiveness, you know? Like, it was extremely powerful. A great exploration of something that doesn't, and understandably doesn't, get explored a lot in superhero fiction. And when it does, often isn't done well one way or the other. So I love the episode for that. On top of that, you mentioned also, Nick, getting to see Nightcrawler in action. The teleportation power was something we hadn't really seen. The unique agility, the wit, the German accent, all of it was great. And seeing an episode that just – and the X-Men was always wonderful about this. I say wonderful, I don't mean that these characters were wonderful. I mean it that X-Men was always brave enough, the creators were brave enough to present the worst in humanity, if that makes sense, to present people that would hate someone for no reason other than the fact that they don't have the same skin color, that they look different. And that's actually something I forgot to mention about one of the other episodes on my list, the number 3 episode, One Man's Worth. There's actually a great scene in a diner in the 1950s when Bishop, Wolverine, Storm, and Shard meet with Xavier at this 50s diner, and they get kicked out, not because they're mutants, but because Storm and Bishop and Shard are black. And they actually call attention to that fact, and Storm says, "Skin-based prejudice? This is ridiculous." And the guy says, "We don't take you kind around here. You must be some sort of genetic abomination," or something like that. And he's not referring to their mutant abilities. And you also see a similar thing in Nightcrawler, where these people hate Kurt, not because of who he is, but because of what he is, because of what he looks like. It's heady stuff for a kid. I think I was 12. I think I was 11 when this episode came out, maybe even 10. And it's heady stuff for a 10-year-old to see on a cartoon. So for my money, it doesn't get any more impactful than this. I acknowledge there were more action-packed episodes. I acknowledge there were probably more comic book accurate episodes. But this, to me, is the most powerful of the episodes.
I agree, which is why it certainly found a place on my list. And then wrapping it up at number one, you know, I said earlier that I would talk about this one in a bit, and my number one episode of all time is the two-parter "Till Death Do Us Part." This is really, you know, Greg, you talked about the fact that really every episode led into the next, and every action had consequences, and every little storyline led somewhere. There was no wasted motion in terms of plot movement. And this two-parter really felt like the culmination of a lot of things that had come before. You had the Jean and Scott wedding. You had the return of Morph, which was emotionally devastating, especially for our favorite character, Wolverine, who, when that is revealed, you can see how it is deeply affecting him. You had you know, just so much going on in this episode. Like you said, Sinister, who had been teased for a long time, finally making his impact felt in a big bad way. And it just felt like every character had something going on in this episode that yet all managed to tie together in a cohesive way. Something that I really haven't seen it attempted on this level. I think the only shows that have come close are probably Justice League, and Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes in terms of being able to take individual storylines and tie them all in to this really cohesive narrative. It's just an impressive piece of writing and plotting from the creative team behind this series. But, you know, whether it's Gambit and Rogue continuing to play up their sexual tension, quite frankly, or it's, you know...
Don't you know? Gambit loves you, Cher.
You got that going on. You got Charles Xavier being duped by Morph. That was one of the best aspects of the episode, was how Morph was really just playing them all like a fiddle. And it was so cool to see. And as someone who was introduced to the show through those, you know, those old VHSs, the death of Morph was something that had really been a big, huge deal. And so by the time I finally saw this episode, it was genuinely a shocking and emotional reveal that Morph was still alive. And like you said, that split personality thing, yet another thing that so many shows never get away with, because really it's almost like a form of mental illness, you know, a form of schizophrenia in some type of way, split personality and whatnot. And the way they handled it, I just thought was so well done. You can make the argument that it's more subtle here than it is in the Sam Raimi Spider-Man film with the Green Goblin. This is just an outstanding example of how this creative team was able to juggle so many things at one time. And, most notably, it actually makes me care about the character of Cyclops, which is something that is very difficult to do in most X-Men-related media. And like you said, the way they continue to play up the Wolverine, Cyclops, and Jean love triangle, I thought the opening scene where Wolverine is refusing to attend the wedding, not because he's being a douche, but because he's genuinely heartbroken, and he's letting that heartbreak out through aggression in the danger room. One of the most effective Wolverine scenes in the entire series, in my opinion. So, you know, I mentioned for Inner Magneto how it was a great example of the types of social storylines they could tell, and I think this one, you know, is my number one because it's a great example of how they could weave so many things together, and it never felt like they were pandering to their audience. They trusted their audience to keep up and be able to know, you know, what was going on at all times. And this is just an outstanding piece of writing from the people behind this show.
Yeah, groundbreaking in many ways, taking us along for the ride and doing things serially rather than on an episode by episode basis. Just an incredible job of tying all these threads together. It was really soap opera. It was high-level soap opera. And weaving these character threads and interactions together, showing how different characters would react in a fight scenario. Because we've seen situations where Wolverine's the only one that can hurt Proteus. But we've seen situations where Wolverine can't really do anything to Mr. Sinister, but Cyclops' blast is mortally damaging to Sinister. So just really cool stuff that they managed, that were introduced all of it introduced in the comics, but the fact that the writers of the show kept up with all of it and replicated it to the best of their ability, incredible. Incredible show. And as we reach the end of our countdown, I hope you guys have gotten a little bit of a sense of why we love this show so much. We probably didn't do the best job necessarily, especially me, of explaining why we love these episodes so much, but a lot of it is just a feeling that you get when you watch it, or an emotion that you have when you're a kid that you hold on to all these years later. And I guess to wrap it up, we'll count down we'll remind you of what our lists were. At number 5, I had Till Death Do Us Part. At number 4, I had Weapon X, Lies, and Videotape. At number 3, I had One Man's Worth. At number 2, I had The Dark Phoenix Saga. And at number 1, I had Nightcrawler. Nick?
Yeah, at number 5, I had Out of the Past. At number 4, I had Nightcrawler. At number 3, I had Weapon X, Lies, and Videotape. At number 2, I had Enter Magneto. And at number 1, I had Till Death Do Us Part.
Well, there you have it, folks. Let us see those lists. I know you've got a list if you watched this show as a kid. Maybe you've revisited it in recent years or watched it for the first time on Hulu. But send us those lists. Tweet them to us. Go to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We'll have a post up to solicit your lists and let us know what your favorite episodes of X-Men the Animated Series are. Whatever criteria you want to use, the funniest, the best action, the best drama, the ones that just stood out the most to you when you were a kid, the ones that hold up the best, whatever you want it to be. We look forward to hearing from you, to getting those lists. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. And the Facebook page, of course, is Place to Be Nation Comics. Let us see those lists, folks. When we come back on the other side, we'll have Read and Watchin' with your rundown of comics for the week, TV for the week, and then we'll close it out with the rundown looking at the biggest news stories in the world of comics. Stay with us.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and, Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Look into my mind. Look for your future.
Failure be so complete.
That's twice I've failed.
It's my fault.
I have summoned the X-Men into a trap.
I shut the defensive perimeter down for the wedding.
You underestimate my feelings for you. But then you always did. You may be the answer to my loneliness.
You must not leave me behind.
I do.
Is this a dream? Yes. I feel so light.
Powers! Ah!
Oh. Hey!
No!
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 What?
I now bind the Phoenix with the power of...
We're back, ladies and gentlemen, and we are ready to delve in to the week that was in comics, at least for us, and television. So that means it's time for...
Reading and watching, what you been reading and watching, ah.
What you been reading and watching.
So, to kick things off, Nick, why don't you lead off with your number three book of the week?
Sure. So my number three book of the week, I have Green Arrow number 19. This is the second part of the Return of Roy Harper storyline. This continues to redefine the origins of the Roy Harper and Oliver Queen relationship for the Rebirth era. It's kind of added some subtlety back into the mix in terms of what exactly led to their partnership coming together and what led to it falling apart. And it really illustrates how both of them were just so emotionally immature and unstable in the early days of their partnership. And it was a relationship that was almost doomed to fail, given the people who they were then. But it also shows how they've both matured since then and how it's possible the partnership now could really work to the benefit of both individuals and really be something that makes them stronger and makes them better people coming out the other side. And also, this represents a great return to the classic, you know, heavily politically influenced Green Arrow stories, in that this is pretty much just a straight-up comic book parallel for the debate over the Dakota Access pipeline that's been dominating the headlines for the better part of what feels like a year or so. So, loved the hell out of Green Arrow number 19.
Excellent. Looking forward to catching up to that book in, of course, 6 to 9 months. With my number three book of the week, I have Titans number 6 by Dan Abnett and Brett Booth. This is the conclusion to the opening arc of Titans, which was a 6-part story called The Return of Wally West, detailing his battle with Abracadabra, or the team's battle with Abracadabra, but primarily Wally. This is Wally in the Speed Force with his memory of Linda Park, who, of course, before the timeline was messed with, was, of course, his wife, who gave him children that we have not yet acknowledged, but have been sort of hinted at. And... you know, this is him in the Speed Force. He's content. He's happy there. But he has that nagging voice in his ear that is Linda telling him that it's not real, that he needs to go back and embrace what's real and go back to the real world and save his friends, the Titans. A lot of really good stuff going on here. All of the best stuff in this issue takes place in the Speed Force. It's all about Wally coming to grips with who he is, what his role is on this earth that he's on, in this timeline that he's in, that has been taken from him and changed and manipulated. He finds his purpose, comes back, saves the day. I have to admit, though, it felt, maybe appropriately enough for a Flash story, it felt a little fast at the end. It felt like the Abracadabra confrontation wrapped up a little too quickly for my taste, Kadabra is just casually tossed into the time stream. So it wasn't a perfect story, but it was a good one.
Glad to hear that. Glad to hear that you enjoyed it. Moving on to my number two book of the week, I've got The Mighty Thor, number 17. This continues the Asgard-Shi'ar War, and this one puts the focus back front and center on, you know, the character of Jane Foster Thor and how she's interacting with these two Shi'ar gods, and it really shows you how she's so utterly different than any of the other Asgardians in that she's humble and loving and caring in a way that, you know, the classic Thor has never really been. She has so much compassion for anybody she comes across, and it really helps to illustrate the difference between her and these very haughty Shi'ar gods that she finds herself in conflict with. Throw in the reveal behind the origins of this conflict, how it all came about, which was one that, you know, I kind of saw coming a little bit, but it was a good reveal nonetheless. And it just, you know, Jason Aaron continues to knock it out of the park each and every issue with both of his current Thor titles. And I continue to say this is going to go down as one of the greatest creator runs of all time when all is said and done, because Jason Aaron is continuing to kill it on the Thor titles.
Glad to hear it. I know you've been enjoying his run on Thor for quite some time now. But my number two book of the time period that I've read is Deathstroke number 8 by Christopher Priest, Larry Hama, and that artist whose name I always forget, Carlo Pagulayan. This is, in a bit of a theme, spoiler alert, for my list this week, this is a Superman guest appearance in Deathstroke. And it's really compelling. I have to be honest, the first half of this comic, I was kind of lukewarm to it. I was like, you know, this is probably, and it probably is one of the weaker issues of Deathstroke, all things considered. But being a weak issue of Deathstroke at this point is like being a weak issue of Greg Rucka's Wonder Woman, in that it's still better than just about any other comic on the market. It's really intriguing as Slade puts Superman in a bit of a moral quandary, and seeing how Clark tries to deal with that is really compelling. And I was worried that it was going to make Clark into an idiot, but then by the end of the issue, you realize that Clark was actually playing Slade the entire time and not the other way around. Really compelling, very interesting, great action, great drama, and again, a wonderful use of Superman that actually ties into a little bit of what Dan Abnett was doing with Superman over in Aquaman. So, number two book of the week, but not because it didn't deserve a number one status. Most weeks this probably would have been good enough for number one, but there was one a little bit better that I read this week.
Gotcha. Well, my number one book of the week is All-Star Batman number 8. This is a book that, you know, like I've been saying, this Ends of the Earth storyline has really just taken this title to a whole other level. This issue focuses on Batman tracking down the Mad Hatter and having an interaction with him. And what's really cool about this one is it presents the idea that, you know, Batman has felt the effects of the Mad Hatter's control before, but the Mad Hatter here is trying to convince Batman that the cowl is really, and his entire existence as Batman is a manifestation of an early meeting between Bruce Wayne and Jervis Tetch, in which Tetch was pitching his technology, and that Bruce Wayne is the reality and Batman is the myth. And so you get this exploration of Batman and Bruce talking to each other as two separate individuals, and Bruce trying to rationalize what exactly is going on, what's real, and how he should handle it. And the way Snyder writes it, the way the book is laid out, the way the book is drawn, it's just mind-blowingly good. It's amazing how trippy this book is at times, and really, I would say, is one of the better Mad Hatter stories I've ever read, which doesn't cover a ton of ground, but it really adds this whole other level of menace and intellect to the character in a way that, you know, typically he's just portrayed as either sniveling or somebody who wants to cornhole the Joker. So this has been, you know, just a great way of kind of reinventing that character a little bit. I can't wait for you to read it. This is among the best things that Snyder has done with the character.
Looking forward to that. Very much looking forward to it. Snyder has had a way of putting a unique spin on some of Batman's traditional rogue gallery, so that should be a good one, no doubt. My number one book of the time period is Titans number 7 by Dan Abnett and, importantly, Lee Weeks on art and not the usual Titans artist Brett Booth. I am a big, big fan of Lee Weeks in general, but especially Lee Weeks when he draws Superman. And this, as I hinted at earlier, is another Superman guest appearance, and it is excellent. It's Wally West and the Rebirth Superman, who of course we know is the Superman of the pre-Flashpoint DC Universe, who is the only character to this point who remembers Wally West as he was. Knows Wally. Knows Wally's backstory. Knows Linda. And so it gives Wally, for the first time, a chance to really talk with somebody who gets it. And they explicitly say that in the story, that Superman gets it. And he's someone that Wally can talk to. Because, yes, while Superman is a man on a different world than he's used to, he's still got the people he loves. He's got Lois and he's got John. Wally doesn't have anybody. He doesn't have Linda. And he doesn't even know that he had kids before. So it's there's just this something missing from his life, and Superman gets it. Just tremendous issue. I can't say much more about it, but it was excellent. I would say it's probably my favorite issue of Titans to this point.
Outstanding to hear. Moving on to our bottom books of the week, you know, you just mentioned Superman, and I got to mention Superman here. Because I'm going with Superman number 19 as my bottom book of the week. This is part 3 of the Superman Reborn storyline. And I don't really want to say too much here about, you know, this book. Because I know you're very much looking forward to reading it. And you don't really want to have too many things spoiled for you. I will say this. I am going to wait to pass Ultimate Judgment until I see, you know, how the final part of Superman Reborn plays out. But the last page reveal here, and the tease of a return to a Superman concept from the 90s that is not among my favorite concepts in comics, I'll put it that way, have me very, very concerned about the future of the Superman line going forward, and it makes me worry that DC may have missed the point of Superman's success thus far, and be... I am concerned they may be undoing a little bit of some of the stuff they've done in Rebirth, and I am not interested in that in the least. If we start to take steps backward in terms of this version of the character, then I'm probably going to be dropping the Superman line, because that's not, you know, what they're teasing here is not why I'm reading the Superman line. I'll put it that way.
Very, very concerning, and I have similar concerns, I think. We'll see where it all goes. I don't have any other books, Nick. I didn't read any more books. I just read 3 this week. So carry on with your quick hits.
Oh, awesome. I got Batman number 19, continues to move forward the I Am Bane storyline, and it has Bane having a little mini showdown with each individual member of the Rogues Gallery, or each of the notable members anyway, in a pretty cool little book. Super Sons number 2, I thought this was a big improvement from Super Sons number 1. Enjoyed the interplay between Damian and John one hell of a lot. Batwoman number 1, already the art from Steve Epting makes this one of the most beautiful damn books on the stands, and big pop for seeing Julia Pennyworth back in action. Green Lanterns 19, putting the Rebirth spin on the character of Dr. Polaris in a truly intriguing fashion that I thoroughly enjoyed, and also providing some more personal drama for Simon Baz to go through. Aquaman 19, providing the return of the villain known as Deadwater, which I thoroughly loved, and quickly killing off the characters of the Aquamarines, or some of them anyway, who I thought were cheesy, dumb characters from the previous storyline, so glad to see that. Trinity number 7, this one is a fill-in issue written by Cullen Bunn, and, you know, in true Cullen Bunn fashion, he used that opportunity to do a Dark Trinity storyline, a Dark Trinity of Ra's al Ghul, Lex Luthor, and Circe, the Wonder Woman villain, and kind of looking at this what seems to be this destiny that they all three share and exactly what that can be. And it's really cool to see the, how their interplay together and how they each think about their respective nemesis.
That's an interesting thing. I don't know that I've seen Lex and Ra's really interact that much.
Before. No, nor have I. And it was a really cool take, especially given the fact that Lex is supposed to be turning all over something of a heroic leaf lately. And then finally, I've got Spider-Man number 14. This is the fifth part of the Sitting in a Tree storyline. Probably the weakest issue of this storyline thus far, but still serviceable enough. And ready to see how this one wraps up in the next issue of Spider-Gwen.
Awesome. Well, that brings an end to reading, which can only mean that it's time for watching. What we've been watching. Well, as is often the case, we've been watching the CW DC Universe shows. And there was no Supergirl last week for unexplained reasons. So let's get started on Tuesday night with The Flash. And The Flash brought us to a place we've been before, but a place that's always interesting to go. A place where everybody knows your name. No, not the local bar. It's the Speed Force, because Barry goes into the Speed Force to attempt to retrieve Wally, who we found out in the last episode was trapped there by Savitar. Along the way, he meets manifestations of characters who have come and gone from the show, characters such as Eddie Thawne, Ronnie Raymond. I was thinking about Robbie Amell, the actor that plays him. Ronnie Raymond.
Ronnie, of course.
Ronnie. Who else did he encounter in the Speed Force?
Eddie Thawne, Ronnie, yep. Snart.
Snart, Leonard Snart, Captain Cold. All of these, of course, manifestations created by the Speed Force to screw with Barry's mind a little bit and to try and impart a lesson on him.
Right, to try and teach him a lesson more so than to screw with him, I would say.
And he also encounters Zoom while he's in there, or the husk of Zoom, the Black Flash.
The Black Flash, or Death the Black Racer, or whatever version of the character they're making him.
And really imparting their disappointment with Barry for his actions at the end of last season. We, Nick and I, have lamented the actions of Barry at the end of last season because they seemingly undid the emotional effects of the Kevin Smith-directed episode last year where... In his communication with the Speed Force, Barry seemingly came to grips with the death of his mother. Well, happily enough, the Speed Force called Barry out on his BS.
Yep.
And that was very effective, I thought. That satisfied me, made me feel a little bit better about how things went down the last time. And also, we got a pretty cool confrontation, I thought, between Jesse Quick and Savitar. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it kind of—I wasn't super thrilled about the fact that Jesse gets sent away at the end to Earth, to a different Earth. I didn't understand why she didn't just go back to Earth 2 with her dad. But
well, they explained that
she said to Earth 3 needs somebody to protect it. But what about Earth 2? Does it not need somebody to protect it?
Well, I think her thought is that, you know, she has seen Earth 2. She knows it's fairly calm, and also if she's concerned about Savitar hunting her down. I think in her mind, she would want to be somewhere where he wouldn't think to look.
Okay. Well, that's fair.
Because, she makes reference to the fact that part of the reason she's leaving is that Savitar said he had specific plans for her. And so she wants to make sure, I think, she's as far away from Wally to help to ensure that Wally and Barry don't come under, you know, any additional danger as a result of her being there.
Right. And I guess I get that. I still think that having three speedsters to oppose Savitar makes more sense than just two, but that's just my opinion. But I didn't have as much of an issue with that as I had with the end of this episode, where I know Nick that you said that you we talked off air about this and you said you bought the explanation.
Well, I bought it in terms of the context of the episode. I don't think it was a. I don't like that the writers chose to go there. I don't like that this is the route the show is going. But I thought, to me, there is enough of a link between the events that happen in the Speed Force and the decision that Barry makes to justify it in terms of motivation.
If he does what you suggested, because basically Barry splits it off with Iris And Nick's thought is that Barry, it's a step one of Barry slowly pushing everyone away.
Right, because the lesson, you know, last year when he went into the Speed Force, the lesson that the Speed Force was attempting to teach him was that he needed to come to grips with his mother's death. And as long as he was still fixated on that, he couldn't really move forward as a person or as a Flash. And he was able to do that. This year, the Speed Force is refusing to release Wally because it is basically saying to Barry that, Barry, your consequences have actions. You know, you
or
went
your
back
actions
in time.
Even have consequences.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Actions have consequences. Sorry. You went back in time and created Flashpoint. You are directly responsible for Wally getting his powers. You were the one who chose to put the burden of saving Iris off onto Wally and directly led to him being here. You have to learn that some things are your responsibility. And I think the entire thing, the entire, you know, lesson it was attempting to teach him was about consequences and about responsibility. And I think that Barry has learned that lesson to a certain extent, but I think that in an attempt to overcorrect from not really truly learning the lesson last year, he is going to take the lesson the Speed Force taught him and apply it in the wrong way. He's going to apply it by thinking that everything is his responsibility, that he is solely responsible for everyone and everything, and I think this is the first step in him slowly pushing everyone away. You've already heard him make the unilateral announcement that Wally is off the board for the time being, even though Wally never says that to the team. Barry makes that announcement. I'm not saying Wally's not okay with it, but I think Barry is somebody, I think, in my head anyway, Barry is pushing that. I think Barry is pushing Iris away. It would not surprise me in the coming weeks to see Barry push Joe away, to push the team away. I think you're going to see a Barry that is increasingly isolated and that is increasingly taking too much of the responsibility and too much of the blame for everything onto his shoulders. And as a result of that, I think that's why he made that choice with Iris at the end. Again, I don't love it. I think there were other ways to go about it without doing that, but I can understand it from a motivational standpoint.
I agree. Hey, you make a great case. You make an absolutely great case. My counter to that is I feel like we've seen this theme play out over and over and over and over again on The Flash and on Arrow, where the
right,
hero,
but
hero takes on, when we see him, it seems like they go through cycles of bring people in, push people
right.
away, bring people in,
agree.
Push people away.
And I agree with that, but the counter to that would be, so Barry is always, you know, conflicted with himself, you know, should I be trusting others or kind of taking this on myself? And he feels like he was basically just directly told by for all intents and purposes, a seemingly omnipotent force that he needs to take responsibility. They have removed the choice and the conflict for him. To him, he feels like, I have been directly told to do this from on high, essentially.
Right. So let's be pragmatic about it, though. Let's be practical about it. What does breaking up with Iris actually accomplish? Does Savitar forget that he loves Iris? Does Savitar think that he no longer loves Iris because he broke up with her? Does Savitar forget how to find Iris?
I think that it's an attempt. You know, he knows now that he is the only one who can save Iris, that he has to take that responsibility on himself. And I think misguidedly, he thinks that anything else is distracting him from that main goal and is going, you know, he is going to seek to limit attachments to others to focus solely on the goal of becoming faster, which lends itself to another theory I have about I think you and I share about the show.
Yes.
And so it's yeah. all, to me, tied into this theme of Barry has always danced around. What they've always done with Barry is they've put over how he is different from Oliver in that his humanity and his compassion is what makes him who he is. And so when you start to think, what happens if he starts to lose that a little bit, lose that connection to others, lose that, you know, that compassion and lose, you know, that humanity, what could happen? And I think that's part of the story they are attempting to tell with Barry and, quite frankly, Savitar.
So that, yeah, and I think not to put too fine a point on it, but the concept that we have that we're talking about here is that Barry, the actions that he's taking are unwittingly turning himself into Savitar in the long
run. Yes.
So Right now, our leaders in the clubhouse who are most likely to be Savitar would be, in order, Barry and then Wally. So,
and then I will throw a distant third to Jay as well.
And just to cover all bases, I'm going to throw out David Hasselhoff as a possibility as well.
What about Wells, HR?
He's on the list somewhere. I don't think it could be HR. I think they pretty well eliminated that possibility, unless it's a future twisted version of HR. But I don't think it's HR. It could be A. Wells, though. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that it's Harry Wells. But that's an unlikely possibility. Somewhere around the Hasselhoff possibility. So, that wraps up The Flash. Let's move on to a completely different style of episode, and that is Legends of Tomorrow, which took the team back to the space race, to the Apollo 13 mission, to be specific, because the Reverse Flash finds out that Commander Steel, is it?
Yes.
Hid the last fragment of the Spear of Destiny somewhere on the moon. And
more specifically, in the flagpole that Neil Armstrong planted on the moon during the Apollo 11 lunar mission.
Yes. So the team goes back, and this gives the writers carte blanche to make every Apollo 13 joke they can possibly think of. And it's awesome. And along the way, we find Steel working for NASA and talking to his grandson, Nate, who we know as Steel. And they interact with one another and do their grandson-grandfather deal. And they kind of work out some family issues along the way. Meanwhile, the rest of the Legends team goes up into space to try and retrieve the spear, because Reverse Flash has commandeered the Apollo 13 rocket and is going up to the moon to take this last piece of the spear. Along the way, Ray Palmer ends up trapped in a space shuttle with the Reverse Flash, forced to work with him. Meanwhile, Martin Stein and Mick Rory have to try and distract the people at Houston from understanding what all's going on way above the Earth. It sounds like a lot going on, and it is, but man alive, if this wasn't one of the most entertaining hours of Legends of Tomorrow that I've seen yet. I absolutely adored this episode. We got the funniest moment of the episode, without question, had to be Martin Stein randomly standing up and singing Tally Me Banana. And being joined without asking by Mick Rory in doing so. Amazing moment. You have Ray Palmer completely ripping off The Martian and trying his best to be Matt Damon, which was awesome. Actually, Ray Palmer had just tremendous line after tremendous line after tremendous moment throughout this episode. And surprisingly emotional for a character. I like the character of Nate, but usually more for comedic value. This was really the first time I've had an emotional attachment to his character. I really, really thought the scene where his grandfather sacrifices himself was well done. This, to me, was one of the best episodes of the season. Just immensely entertaining, and in a completely different way from what is a good Flash episode and what is a good Arrow episode.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I don't think I liked it as much as you did. Still enjoyed it a hell of a lot. I think part of my reason is, outside of the self-sacrifice scene, as I have any other time he's appeared on the show, I find the guy who plays Nate's granddad, you know, the Commander Steel, to be incredibly wooden. Like, there's something about that guy that just puts me off a little bit. So while I still enjoyed this episode, I would say I didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoyed that little run they had earlier this back half of the season of, like, the Lucas episode, the Legion of Doom episode, and the there was one other that kind of had that little run of three straight weeks of just outstanding episodes. So I would kind of put it, you know, behind those three, but ahead of stuff like the Camelot episode and the there was another one that happened this back half as well. So probably middle of the road for me in terms of the episodes since the mid-season return, but still a great episode nonetheless.
Right. And as to your point about the actor, I agree with you, but I think it actually worked in the context because he was playing kind of a stuffy Ed Harris kind of guy from Apollo 13.
I'm even talking about going back to the Justice Society of America.
Oh, no. Yeah, I don't disagree with you either, but I think in this episode it didn't bother me because I think it kind of worked for the time period and the kind of role that he was playing. As the militaristic grandfather that's kind of like, you know, doesn't wear his emotions on his sleeve, so to speak. Also enjoy the dynamic now between Rip and Sarah, how Rip is kind of coming to terms with the fact that Sarah is a better captain than he was, but that Rip still has value to the team. Thought that was really good. So yeah, enjoyable episode. And that brings us to Wednesday night, which was the revelatory episode of Arrow, in which Oliver finally finds out the identity of Prometheus and finds out that Prometheus, aka Adrian Chase, was trained by the very woman who helped him become the Green Arrow in the first place, which is Talia al Ghul. Now, granted, he never knew she was an al Ghul until this episode. He shows up to where he is told that Talia is and learns the truth that yes, Talia helped him in the past, but all that changed the minute that he killed her father. Because for all the messed up family dynamics in the Al Ghul clan, he was still her father, and so she nurses a grudge with Oliver. And Oliver's would-be girlfriend, Susan Williams, is now caught in the crosshairs of Prometheus's game. We find out a lot about how sadistic Adrian Chase is, how much he hates Oliver, and what he is willing to sacrifice in the name of his vendetta. This was a great episode in a string of great episodes for Arrow. I've said it all season long, but the actor who is playing Adrian Chase is just doing an incredible job. Because earlier in the season, I was remarking upon how heroic he was, how he's playing this almost like determined Harvey Dent-like district attorney who was in some ways more heroic than the hero of the show himself. But now he's turned that switch, and now he is a gleeful supervillain who seems to be taking joy in the pain that he's causing Oliver and others, and seems to be in control of every situation that he's in. It's been wonderful. I think the villains on Arrow have always been one of the show's strengths. This one is setting up to be one of the best.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. Been an outstanding little run of Arrow episodes the last couple of weeks. I did like getting to see this other side of Chase, like you said, you know, kind of seeing the heroic side, now seeing the sadistic, manipulative, villainous side of the character. The decision he makes as it pertains to his wife. So much going on in this episode, including what I think is a pretty interesting subplot of Felicity pretty clearly falling further and further down this rabbit hole that I think she's not really going to know how to get herself out of. And I would hope that it would help her to understand a little bit why Oliver makes tough choices and keeps secrets from people, and perhaps provide a little bit of closure to that dangling thread of their relationship that's still kind of out there and hasn't really been addressed since the forced breakup of last season. So, a lot going on in this episode, but needless to say, I absolutely loved it, and I think the show is really hitting its stride in a big, bad way, and the little, like, 90-second or whatever, you know, 60-second teaser we got for next week's episode, I can't wait, man. It looks like one of the most intriguing episodes the show has done in a long, long time.
And we haven't even talked about the flashbacks, which bring us more Anatoly, which, as we have said in the past, is a formula for success.
Yep. Agreed.
So, with that being said, let's rank them for the week. I'll start us off. Mm-hmm. I will go Arrow, Legends, Flash.
And I'm going to go Flash, Arrow, Legends.
Very good. Now, that brings us to Sunday night and AMC's The Walking Dead. This was an episode that seems to be setting the stage for the battle that is to come against the Saviors. We see the kingdom starting to try and get their shit together, basically. And Sasha and Rosita begin their two.
You mean the hilltop?
Oh, sorry, yeah, the hilltop, not the kingdom. The hilltop. We see Gregory, my namesake, who is the leader of the hilltop, be as sniveling as he always is. And we notably see Sasha and Rosita begin their two-woman crusade to assassinate Negan. And we get a little cameo from Nick's favorite character, Dr. Eugene Porter, along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was a very good episode. This really seems to be setting the stage for everything that's to come. Even if the actions of Rosita and Sasha are maddeningly stupid.
Yeah, they really are. Like I said before, this whole little, especially with Rosita, this whole little subplot, it felt like they did this and had some closure on it. And it feels like a rehash, a recycle, step backwards for the character, which is something I've criticized the show a little bit for in terms of various characters seeming to just repeat the same actions over and over again, even after they've seemingly, you know, come to terms with the fact that their actions lead them to places they don't want to be. But yeah, the Rosita and Sasha stuff was just, it was by far the least interesting part of the episode, I thought, but all the hilltop stuff was outstanding. You and I discussed offline, you know, Negan and, help me out, Greg, what's the name of his lieutenant who deals with the hilltop?
I honestly don't know. I just call him Mustache Guy.
Yeah, Negan and Mustache Guy, as we'll call him for the purposes of this discussion, are both great villains, but they're so damn charismatic that they're great villains in that you love to hate them kind of way. Whereas Gregory is just one of the show's most effective villains ever in that he's just such a 1980s NWA chicken shit heel that you want to see so desperately get his comeuppance. And he just snivels and backstabs his way out of seemingly every situation that I can't wait until that character finally gets what's coming to him. He's so effective.
A good analogy, Negan is Shooter McGavin, and Gregory is the attorney from Billy Madison.
Yes, that's a great analogy for sure. Who would be Coach Red Bowieu in that scenario then?
Oh my gosh, maybe the governor.
Maybe the governor would be Coach Red Bowieu. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, this whole thing with Gregory is really working for me in a big way. I thought the scene with Maggie and Daryl hiding in the cellar had some great, like, mm-hmm. truly, truly tense moments. I really just loved everything about this episode for the most part. Everything hilltop related, like I said.
Yeah, and we learned a little bit about Rosita's backstory, which we've never gotten.
Yeah, but I don't care. Like the character is clearly not long for the world, I think. And you've waited. She's been on the show, what, almost 3 seasons now? And you've waited this long to give us any kind of a reason to care about her? No. I mean, she's too far gone at this point, for me anyway. And again, he was only in the episode for like 45 seconds, but I'm pretty sure Dr. Eugene Porter's bit on the walkie-talkie stole the damn episode with Negan is going to be indisposed in the boudoir for the foreseeable future. That means this operation reports to me, Dr. Eugene Porter, also known as Negan, who I also am.
That's good.
Outstanding.
Yeah. My one complaint about Porter at this point, Eugene, is I'm ready for them to show some sort of middle level for him between stoic deadpan humor and bawling like a 6-year-old who's just been scolded by his parents. Like, I swear, every other episode he's in, he's either deadpan humoring or crying, just literally crying about something. And I know
he's clearly the most emotionally fragile of all the characters on the show, and
yeah,
there's some sort of mental or social issue going on with him. So I can kind of understand it and forgive it. I still think there's a little bit... There is more going on with him than just he's joined the Saviors. I think it's clear that fear is something that drives this character in a big way. And he knows. I mean, he's been spending time at the Saviors compound. He knows how much, how badly Negan wants to find Daryl. And he knows that if he seeks to leave, even in that moment, it's going to put him squarely in Negan's crosshairs, and that is not something he wants. Mm. So I think he is still attempting to play the long game here.
Yeah, you may be right, but unfortunately his attempting to play the long game is probably going to get Sasha killed, because I don't think either of us expects her to survive past the next couple episodes, right?
No, and I mean, it's not that I dislike Sasha, but I can't say that her death is going to affect me in some huge way.
I don't know. I don't really think she... I hesitate to say this because I don't think that she serves too much of a role on the show, honestly. But man alive, it really isn't going to do much to dispel my old theory about, you know, they can only have a certain number of minority characters on the show at once. But
well, remember, Dr. Dre may or may not be coming back to the show at some point.
That's true. So. God, what a... I'm sorry, his character was not interesting at all.
No.
Maybe we can get T-Dog resuscitated.
Oh, if we are resuscitating season one characters, Greg, there is only one that deserves to be brought back from the Netherworld.
I would stop watching.
And show. I would love if you know.
You want to talk about big, Charles Xavier?
You want to talk about no. Here's how it happens. They're having the big climactic showdown with the Saviors. Alexandria is under siege. The gates are burning down around them, and plowing through the gate comes the RV, and out the top of the hatch pops Dale with a sniper rifle, and the eyebrows twitch up and down as he takes out savior after savior. Mark out moment for yours truly if that happens.
The eyebrows. The eyebrows would judge Negan harshly.
They would judge him harshly. That's true.
In fact, that's not even, he doesn't even need a sniper rifle. Dale's ghost appears like a force ghost to Negan and just starts lecturing him about everything that he's doing wrong in life. And then even when Negan changes his behavior, he gets lectured for that too. It would be effective. I agree with you on that.
All this goes back to your defense of the character of Shane repeatedly and how Dale was one of the few characters willing to call him out on his shit all the time.
I want to know, Nick, let's take a poll of everybody in the house before we do this action. And then, whatever that decision is, we'll go with it. What? You all voted the way I didn't want you to vote? What's wrong with you people? I refuse to participate.
Well, Greg, I mean, not to dive too deep into real-world stuff, but sometimes groups make poor decisions when it comes to votes.
But what I'm saying is, you can't say, let's take a vote on this, this will be the determining factor. And then when the vote doesn't go your way, pout in the corner and say, I'm not going to participate in the process. That is unfair to the group.
He still participated. He just clearly wasn't afraid to show his disdain for their poor decision.
He was pretty much killed off immediately thereafter, was he not?
Unfortunately, yes.
He deserved it.
He didn't deserve it.
He did. And
Shane deserved it.
You want to talk about Charles Xavier never giving up the moral high ground, being an unsufferable
dude. Let me just say this. Given your feelings on Shane, your defense of his actions from seasons one and two, all I'll say is I hope I never die and you're left alone with my wife. I'll put it that way.
What happens in the jungle during the zombie apocalypse stays in the jungle during the zombie apocalypse.
Bro code, sir. The bro code.
Hey, I'm not defending everything. Shane had his flaws. Certainly, he might have. There might have been a couple things he did wrong.
He killed Otis.
There might have been a few things he did wrong. Maybe a couple.
He screwed Rick's girlfriend. He attempted to rape Lori in the shower at the CDC.
The only thing Shane ain't done is make a baby.
Good Lord. I'm glad he's gone.
I'm not. I think I was Shane. That's who needs to come back. If Shane was leading instead of Rick, they would have never been in this pickle. He'd have taken out Negan just like that.
And rained down a world of hurt upon himself.
Well, so be it. I'm still of the opinion that the Saviors would fall apart without Negan. They crumble into anarchy.
Eventually, probably.
I don't think Mustache Man is capable of leading them.
It isn't like taking out the central droid, you know, ship in episode one or anything. They're not just going to instantly shut down as soon as Negan is dead. It would take them some time.
I like that the comparison is automatically episode one. I think that I think Walking Dead from here on out should take all of its cues from episode one. Structurally, thematically, dialogue, everything. Why not?
Well, if it leads to Carl choking Enid to death and then putting on a suit of armor, maybe that'll make him moderately more interesting.
Awesome. Well, that brings an end to watching an enjoyable episode of The Walking Dead this week. Let's move on to our news and notes, and that, of course, is known as...
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
So let's get right into it with the DCEU Corner. And we always seem to have news and notes about this. Our first bit of news and note comes in yet another bit of kind of bizarre in its own way. I don't want to say negative news, really, but just weird news. Aquaman, which everyone's been anticipating, seems to be speeding along in pre-production, seems to be the only non-already finished DC movie that is actually progressing well at the moment. As far as filming goes and preparations go, Aquaman has been delayed, and it has been moved from October of 2018 to December of 2018. Not a big delay, admittedly. Nick, what are your thoughts on this delay, which will put it up against the animated Spider-Man from Sony?
I think this is a bad move. I think this is a bad move on multiple fronts. One, you and I have discussed how even if there's a legitimate good reason behind this, one of the problems Warner Brothers / DC film is facing right now is that they're losing the public relations battle. And the announcement of this film being delayed, whether right or wrong, is going to lead some people to assume that means the production is troubled in some shape, form, or fashion. So that's one thing. Two, the idea... You know, a lot of these superhero movies, yes, you're going to open big, but the way you really accumulate the big box office totals is to, you know, build week over week, kind of put together a strong little run there. Well, Greg, what has December kind of become known for the last 2 years?
Star Wars.
And yes, I understand that currently there is not a Star Wars movie slated to release in December of 2018. It has heavily been rumored by pretty much all of the Star Wars fan sites and reporting sites that that is going to change, because each of the Star Wars films that has been rumored for a May release has eventually been moved to a December release. So I would be highly surprised if there doesn't wind up being a Star Wars movie slated for December of 2018. Just my opinion, nothing to back that up, but throw that in there with the fact that I am of the opinion that the animated Miles Morales Sony movie is going to be focused towards a younger audience and marketed like a kid's movie, something in the vein of Kung Fu Panda or Despicable Me. Maybe not quite to that level, but I think it's going to be something that is clearly marketed for a younger generation, and those movies always make mega bucks because parents and kids, you know, parents are dragged to the theater by their kids. And I think December just provides this minefield of competition that October typically, most years, and I haven't really looked in depth at the 2018 calendar, does not tend to provide. So I don't really understand this one, to be honest.
Perhaps Aquaman will go after a different audience, as did Logan from Lego Batman.
That's true, but Lego Batman opened 2 weeks before Logan, 2 or 3 weeks before Logan, whereas currently they're slated to go head-to-head with this Spider-Man movie. And Aquaman, I'm assuming, is going to have a PG-13 rating, which means it's going to be more aimed at a general audience than Logan was. And so I think there's more potential for the audience to be fractured between that and the animated Spider-Man movie, if that even winds up happening. Oftentimes, when there are movies scheduled for these similar dates, one winds up budging, you know, one or the other. And I'm fairly sure that will happen.
And for the record, I'm playing devil's advocate here because I actually don't think that Aquaman needs to go after the Logan audience. I think Aquaman needs to go after a general audience, which includes kids and families and grown-ups alike. I don't think Aquaman – I don't think they need to double down on capturing the whatever audience they were going for with Suicide Squad and, to a lesser extent, Batman vs. Superman. I think they need to – yes, Aquaman, I think, is going to be serious and it's going to be a little gritty, and that's fine. But I think they need to make sure that they also are trying to appeal to kids and make this a character that kids are going to want to grow up with. So, you know, it needs to be, in other words, a movie for everyone as best you can do that. Because you can't make a movie truly for everyone, but make a movie that if a parent takes their kids to see it, they're not going to feel like, oh my God, this was a huge mistake. I'm never going to let my kid watch this.
Agreed completely. So, yeah, I have a lot of concerns as it relates to this one. But, you know, we'll see how it all turns out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's that big of a deal, but and I would be surprised if that date doesn't move a little bit as well.
Either it's going to move or the Spider-Man animated date is going to move.
Yeah.
It's one or the other. Like, they're not going to open on the same day. That never happens, ever.
But while we are in the DCEU and we're talking about Aquaman getting delayed, it's created an opening. And according to the oft-loved reports, Warner Brothers is now looking to fast-track another DC film. This is according to Variety's Justin Kroll. Warner Brothers is said to be looking at Gotham City Sirens, The Flash, Green Lantern Corps, Dark Universe, or the untitled Suicide Squad sequel to begin filming in 2017. However,
so The Flash.
Yeah, it won't be The Flash. The Flash, if it's The Flash, we're going to get a really crappy Flash movie because they don't even have a script.
They don't have a script. They don't have a director. They don't have anything outside of Ezra Miller.
Yep. That said, if scripts aren't ready to go, according to Kroll, the studio is content just shooting Aquaman this year until films are ready to go. Of these that have been listed, probably the most likely to get fast-tracked would be Gotham City Sirens or possibly Suicide Squad 2.
Right.
I get nervous when I see the term fast-tracked.
Yep.
Really nervous because as anybody that followed the production of Suicide Squad knows, allegedly, that movie was written in only 2 weeks. And I think it showed in the final product. Yes, that movie has its fans. Yes, it did very good box office. I would argue that the movie was clearly hampered by the amount of time that went into writing it.
Among numerous other factors
right,
as well.
But I'm just for the point that I'm making here,
right,
I'll focus on that. Now, it feels like Gotham City Sirens is a little more fully developed than some of these others, so maybe that would be fine to start filming this year and get it worked out. But man alive, just get these movies right. That's all that I want at this point is – and I'm like this with comics too. You know, I am probably frustratingly for some not that bothered by delays in comics and stuff like that. I would rather get the final product to be as good as it possibly can than to get it at the previously announced time. And it's not good when movies get delayed, but make sure you get these right. Don't let another Suicide Squad situation happen.
Yeah, I agree. The only aspect of this that sounds good to me, and this is going to be an overly pessimistic view, but I'll go forward with it anyway. I kind of hope that if they are going to fast-track something, if Warner Brothers makes up their mind that come hell or high water, they're going to shoot a DC movie this year, I hope it's Green Lantern Corps. And let me explain why. So at least that can get into pre-production before Justice League comes out. Because as I've said before, if Justice League bombs, the whole thing's going to fall apart. And I would like them to feel like they've already invested money in a Green Lantern movie and feel like they have to go forward so we at least get another bite of the apple as it pertains to Green Lantern on film.
Well, yeah, I certainly do hope that we get a good Green Lantern movie out of this, one way or the other. But sticking to the DCEU, speaking of that Suicide Squad 2 movie, we've talked about in recent weeks that Mel Gibson is heavily rumored to be in talks to direct Suicide Squad 2. Now we have some new names thrown into the mix. One of them is, oh my gosh, Jom Colet-Sara, who is known for directing House of Wax and Run All Night. I've not seen House of Wax. I have seen Run All Night, and it was pretty good. He joins a list that includes Ruben Fleischer, Daniel Espinosa, and Jonathan Levine, all of whom are directors who have kind of mixed resumes. Some good movies thrown in there, some less impressive movies thrown in there. Ruben Fleischer is known as the director of Zombieland, which is an excellent movie. But he's also the director of Gangster Squad, which I've not seen, so I'm not going to judge it, but I have heard was not very good. So,
You would hope that I think there's something to the idea that a Suicide Squad film done more in the vein, more in the tone of Zombieland,
yes,
could really, really have some potential, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Agreed on that. And, you know, for those who haven't seen it, Zombieland is a really, really good zombie-based comedy, as you might expect. Daniel Espinosa is primarily known let me see what he's got here on his agenda for the movie Safe House to this point, which was a Ryan Reynolds, Denzel Washington movie that was actually really entertaining, I thought.
Isn't he also the director of that Life movie that's
coming
out?
Right, but it hasn't come out yet, so I didn't want to.
Right.
I don't know. It could suck for all we know. But
yeah.
But it might be good. I liked Safe House a lot. I really enjoyed
it. Never saw it.
Really enjoyable movie. And then we've got, who's the other guy? Jonathan Levine. And I'm going to pull him up right now.
Warm Bodies, which was the Nicholas Holt zombie love story movie thing, if you remember that.
I don't.
Where the chick falls in love with
that's
the zombie.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. And then 50-50, which I haven't seen.
Oh, 50-50 is outstanding. Outstanding. I know you're not high on Seth Rogen, but I would argue that is among, like, Seth Rogen movies. God, I'd probably put it maybe only behind Knocked Up for me. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is outstanding in that film. It's a really, really good mix of drama and comedy. I highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen
it. So out of these guys, and let's throw Mel Gibson out of the equation for the moment, A, who would you say has the best resume, and B, who would you like to see get the job?
I guess it would be Levine probably has the best overall resume between 50-50 and Warm Bodies, which again I haven't seen, but I know was generally well received by the people who saw it. But I'd kind of like to see Fleischer get the job. I mean, I know he did Gangster Squad, which I haven't seen, and kind of got knocked by a lot of people, but just thinking about Zombieland and thinking about taking that formula and applying it to Suicide Squad, it just seems like such a natural fit, you know, like something, an irreverent tone that I think the first Suicide Squad movie probably could have used, and something that could really benefit that franchise going forward. So I would say Fleischer.
I would tend to agree out of those guys. I think all three would bring something interesting to the role. I think Gibson is still my top choice just because I think it would be so batshit crazy for it to happen. But out of those choices, I think Fleischer tonally would be probably the best choice, even though you could argue that, you know, if they were trying to do a more serious style movie, Levine might be a better choice, but I would like to see that kind of irreverence brought in. So yeah, I agree with you on that. We'll see where all that goes in the DCEU. But let's go from there to the comics, and we lost a legend this week. Legendary co-creator of Swamp Thing, Bernie Wrightson, passed away at the age of 68 after battling brain cancer. Wrightson is known as one of the great horror artists in the history of comics. I will admit that I haven't encountered a lot of his work. A lot of his work is from the Bronze Age, but very well regarded by everyone who has encountered his work. I've seen a lot of his art this week for the first time, and it's pretty breathtaking. So another artistic legend lost to comics. So hopefully DC will publish an omnibus or some sort of collection of his work in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, like you, I'm not overly familiar with a lot of his work, but clearly a legend, clearly a guy that was very well regarded by a lot of people in the industry and, you know, fans as well, and told some very influential stories, and, you know, hopefully he'll be a guy that'll be well remembered by the fandom for years to come.
And sticking to the printed page and to DC Comics, we got an announcement this week that, well, we've had a good run, folks, but alas, DC is kicking off a big summer event, and it's going to kick off with two individual stories, and the event is called Dark Days. It kicks off with Dark Days, The Forge number one, and Dark Days, The Casting number one. And this will, according to DC, kick off a massive summer event that will, quote, stop me if you've heard this before, everybody, break new ground in DC's publishing line, end quote. Bold words. This is going to be headed up by Scott Snyder and James Tynion IV, who have long and storied histories with Batman. And Batman is front and center in the art promoting this event. And check out this team of artists. Andy Kubert, Jim Lee, and John Romita Jr.
This book's never coming out.
Snyder is kind of spearheading the event, according to DC. He says it posits a mystery that traces all the way back to when he started on Batman. Says he's hinted at the mystery over the years with Easter eggs and clues. It begins at the dawn of man and spans generations of heroes and villains, ultimately leading to huge revelations about the past, present, and future of the DC Universe. All the artists are excited about it. It's going to be damn beautiful, the artwork. We know that. Sure to face massive delays, but the artwork, when it comes out, is going to be beautiful. There was a big creative summit, and interestingly enough, one of the aspects about this event is it's got much more input from the artists than prior DC events. According to Jim Lee, that was part of the idea of this summit, that he and Dan DiDio have been talking for a long time about bringing artists back to the table in the creation of these big events. So it could be interesting. We don't know much else about it. We don't know how it ties into the previously announced event that Snyder has planned with Greg Capullo, his Batman artist, that is planned in the near future.
This fall, apparently, is the plan. So
the speculation is that this may tie into that or set that up. We don't know.
Lead directly into it, yeah.
But a lot of people are kind of overreacting to this right now, saying that, well, it's called Dark Days, it's bringing Dark Days. So this is going to be a reversion back from all of the optimism of Rebirth to the gritty, grim, overly serious New 52 era. I think that's an overreaction. I think, you know, we don't know enough about the event. Could it be that? Is it beyond the realm of possibility? I mean, sure, it could be, but we just don't know enough about it. With Scott Snyder at the helm, I have hope. I have no reason to doubt this project. Sounds like it'll be cool, and I'm excited to see what kind of stories they're going to tell.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would say that's an overreaction. I kind of get the idea this has probably been in the works for a while. Remember, the rumor was that when Rebirth started, Geoff Johns sat down with all the various creative teams and kind of mapped out what has been referred to as a tentative 3-year plan. I have a hard time believing that the first major summer event of that 3-year plan would not have been already, like, discussed and, you know, arrangements made for it. So I would say, let's all pump the brakes. I think this is all, you know, part of the plan, so to speak, and let's just let it play out.
The cops have plans. Gordon has plans.
Snyder has plans.
Well, let's stick with DC, move to the TV side of things. We love The Flash. We've been supporters of The Flash from day one. It's been an awesome show. But one thing that we have talked about is the show tends to go back to these speedster villains every season as the big bads. In season one.
Every damn season.
In season one, we had Eobard Thawne, the Reverse Flash. In season two, we had Hunter Zolomon, a.k.a. Zoom. And this season, we have Savitar. But good news is on the horizon. If you're a little tired of seeing Barry fight against people who just happen to be a little bit faster than him until they aren't. Season 4 is confirmed by Andrew Kreisberg, one of the executives behind The Flash, to not be featuring a speedster villain. We know now that the Big Bad will not be a speedster. It will be a different kind of challenge for Barry Allen in Season 4. Nick, your thoughts on this revelation?
I like it, first of all. I think it, well, I would agree that, you know, speedster villains present the greatest, you know, physical threat to Barry in terms of being able to match him in with his power set and whatnot. I think it has been done, you know, over and over a little bit to this point. And finally, this has got to be the Rogues, right?
Like, got to be.
I mean, that is, when you talk about the Flash, the thing that kind of separates him from all the other heroes in comics is that his Rogues gallery is kind of unified in a way that no other Rogues gallery really is. They work together, and they have a genuine camaraderie at times. And I think that's something we haven't really seen translated onto the television screen. I mean, at times you'll get, you know, little two or three member team ups, but I'm talking like a full on 5, 6, 7 Rogue, you know, panel coming after Barry and the team. And I think it especially makes sense now that you would want the Rogues to form almost as a response to Barry now having, you know, Jay and Wally and Jesse Quick all running around with him. Cisco, to a certain extent. I think it just makes sense that the Rogues have to be the next ones up. I mean,
and much like Prometheus has been to Arrow this season, I think Flash needs to pull back the stakes a little bit in terms of every villain that the Flash has faced to this point has literally had the fate of the universe or even the fate of the multiverse at stake in these battles. The Rogues are unique in that their goals are much smaller. They don't care about destroying the multiverse or destroying the universe and remaking it in their image. They basically just want to steal stuff and get away with it.
Yeah.
And I think...
Well, and I think clearly, you know, using them as the big bad for a season, I think their goal would be to, you know, remove the Flash so that they could steal stuff.
Absolutely, but, yeah.
Know, means to an end and whatnot.
Right. It's a needed... The way that Prometheus on Arrow is concerned with defeating with destroying Oliver, as opposed to Damian Dark, who wanted to blow up the city, or Ra's al Ghul, who wanted to cleanse the Earth.
Well, Damian Dark wanted to blow up the world.
The world, yes.
Nuclear war, holocaust, nuclear wasteland.
Yeah,
essentially.
Prometheus has been a return to kind of the, or even, you know, Malcolm Merlyn wanted to destroy a part of the city. Prometheus just wants to destroy Oliver. It's more of a return to Deathstroke than anything else. Flash needs that, I think, to kind of pull. Not, I'm enjoying the Savitar story. Don't get me wrong; it's been great. But I think next year we need to pull back and, you know, refocus and show that not every battle needs to be for the fate of the universe. We talked about this in the Green Lantern comics a while back. That it's been nice to see them tone back to more personal conflicts in the book, in a book like Green Lanterns. So, yeah, hopefully. That will be the case in The Flash Season 4. Moving on to Sony's little-talked-about movie slate, we actually had an announcement from them that looks like there's going to be a Venom movie after all.
Yep.
The October 5th, 2018 has been set aside by Sony's Columbia Studios to do a Venom feature. We don't know how or if it will connect to Marvel's upcoming Spider-Man reboot, Spider-Man Homecoming. I would assume that it won't tie into that.
Not directly at first, I would think. I would think there would be the potential that you could possibly cross them over at some point if you wanted to, but I don't think there's going to be direct references.
I'm imagining this will be its own entity, and it looks like Alex Kurtzman is still attached to direct it. I don't know that they have a script. I don't know that they have a premise for it yet. You know, who knows? But
they have a premise. I'm pretty sure I know what the premise is.
What that is.
The premise is, let's get some of that Logan money. That's what the premise is. I don't think the announcement of this is any coincidence whatsoever. Like, I think they're looking at the Spider-Man properties they have the rights to and going, what can we do that lifts that formula, and scanning down with their finger and seeing Venom and going, that, make the
and
Venom
by that
movie
formula,
and do it like
you
Logan.
Don't mean a thoughtful, compelling movie. You mean
no,
a violent
no.
movie.
A violent, over-the-top, R-rated movie.
Now, as somebody who admittedly likes Venom, read the Venom Lethal Protector series when I was a kid,
yep.
Even I have to say, I don't know what the hook is for a Venom standalone movie.
I think the hook is, you know, you can do kind of an anti-hero movie that hasn't really been done a ton to this point. I mean, you could make the argument that the Punisher films were anti-hero movies, Deadpool for sure. But the idea is that Sony hasn't really had the opportunity to do one of those. You can kind of reach a different audience. My concern becomes, if you're completely divorcing it from the rest of the Spider-Man line, like, who is the threat? Like, who is he going to face? Are you going to do Venom versus Carnage, like, right off the bat? Are you going to do Eddie Brock as Venom? Are you doing Flash Thompson? Are you doing Matt? I mean, what exactly are you doing?
I'm going to work on these. They've got to do Eddie Brock. I mean, they're not...
I would think
not
so.
Start with any of the other ones, and the problem.
But
is
then again,
you,
I mean,
how
like,
do you tell the story?
How do you do Eddie Brock without?
How do you tell the story of the symbiote existing, coming to Earth, inhabiting a body and corrupting it, then that person overpowering it and forcing it to help it save people? That's a lot for one movie.
It is. It is. You could just have but the symbiote will just fall out of the sky, a la Spider-Man 3 or something.
Yeah,
you know?
It's going to be a rushed movie, I'm sure. But yeah, you know, I would assume you have Eddie Brock and you have him fight Carnage somehow.
Carnage in the first movie seems a little weird, though.
Yeah, but I mean, who else could Venom's opponent be?
I don't know.
Maybe you present a more heroic version of Eddie Brock, and you have the symbiote splits off and goes in two different directions, and it finds serial killer Cletus Kasady, and it finds struggling photographer Eddie Brock, and
who works at the
they can use the they can
New
use
York...
the Daily Bugle, can't they?
They can, but I mean, again, like that's why the whole issue of how this is tied into the Spider-Man universe at this point is really where it's going to become a little confusing, because all the versions of Venom are so intrinsically tied to Peter, you know, it's going to be tough to...
I got it.
To figure out a way
maybe
to do
as
it.
Maybe as part of the deal to get Spider-Man, Marvel had to trade away the rights to Rick Grimes' favorite Marvel villain, Kang the Conqueror.
That could be a possibility. But no, I you know, maybe I'm just being cynical again, but I am convinced that the timing of this is just it's too coincidental for it not to be a direct response to the success of Logan. That's what it feels like to me anyway.
Yes. Well, let's move over to the MCU, or should we say the MTVU?
Well, it's all part of, in theory anyway, the Marvel Cinematic.
Sure. In
universe.
Theory, and that's what brings us to this news story, Anthony Mackie, who plays the Falcon in the Marvel movies, gave an interview recently, or talked at a presser, and somebody asked about the possibility of the TV characters, the Netflix characters in particular, appearing in the Marvel movies. And he said there is, quote, no chance of that happening, end quote, because he claims that the studios are completely divided. Marvel Cinema is completely separate now from Marvel TV, which plays into the rumors about the split between Kevin Feige and Ike Perlmutter, who runs the Marvel Entertainment Division, with Kevin Feige now reporting directly to Disney. What this means is unclear because Anthony Mackie doesn't really have any authority. Anthony Mackie doesn't call the shots, doesn't probably know the details of everything, but it does lend a lot of credence to what has been said. And let's be honest, there has been no reference at all in the movies to any of the Marvel TV properties. No reference to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or anything else. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
But Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has featured cinematic universe
characters. Since the split. Their last tie-in, the last Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. tie-in that I'm aware of was Age of Ultron. And since then, there has been no connection there. None of the Netflix shows beyond a passing reference to events in New York have tied in. It seems like what we were all excited about from the get-go of this integrated universe has not really played out the way that we thought it would. Even though, again, I'm not knocking it. I enjoy the Netflix series. I love the movies. As separate entities right now, but it looks like we're not really getting that united front that we were initially promised.
I would say this. I think that kind of makes sense on a certain level in that everything right now is building momentum towards Infinity War, and you're building towards Infinity War, and you're going in that direction very clearly. I don't think you can rule it out long term, though. I think after Infinity War, when you see a lot of these these big name actors start to step away from the MCU and you see them kind of start to turn it in a little bit of a different direction and kind of start to look for a new angle to get people interested, I think there's some potential that you could start to see some of these characters come on. Because one thing that Marvel loves to do is to pop its fans, for lack of a better term, with these cool fanboy moments. And I think after Infinity War, they're going to be seeking new ways to do that. Is it overly likely? No. But I still think one day it's going to happen.
Do you I could see it happening. I'm not going to say that I think it'll happen. I think that it could happen. I think that it should happen, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree.
We said that from the get-go. We bitched and moaned about DC not integrating their TV and movie properties, so it's only fair that we do the same with Marvel. I think it has been disappointing to a degree that hasn't happened, but hopefully it will happen one day. I certainly would like to see Daredevil, at the very least, interact with some of the Marvel cinematic characters. So hopefully we'll get to see that one day, and perhaps it'll take the Infinity War to make it happen. But let's move on to the big screen from Marvel, for sure. And you mentioned how Marvel likes to pop its fans. Well, they popped us, Nick, or at least me, by announcing this week that Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 will feature Michael Rosenbaum, who played Lex Luthor on Smallville and voiced the Flash on Justice League, and Sylvester Stallone.
Now, the Sylvester Stallone thing had been out there for a while. It just hadn't been officially confirmed by Marvel until now.
It's confirmed now. And they're playing, quote, two key Marvel characters who have ties to one another. The direct quote from James Gunn, the director of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and writer, is, quote, we do have a couple of characters who are very important to the Marvel Universe who are going to make their debut in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which people don't know about. Sylvester Stallone plays one of these characters. My friend Michael Rosenbaum also has a pretty decent role in the movie as well. And it sort of works in tandem with Sly's character, end quote. Any speculation about who these characters could be, Nick?
Not really, because I'm largely, I'm not really overly familiar with a lot of the cosmic side of Marvel. So I'm just thinking off the top of my head. All right. Rosenbaum as Adam Warlock. and the voice of Sylvester Stallone as Pip the Troll.
Ooh, I can see that. I can see that, yeah.
That's a guess. I mean, like, at best.
Yeah, I mean, who knows, honestly, at this point. It could be...
You would think at some point Quasar probably has to come in. I'm just trying to think of aged characters, because, I mean, Stallone's kind of up there at this point.
So Sylvester Stallone as the Living Tribunal.
I'd be fine with it.
I am the law.
Sylvester Stallone doing a Russian accent as the voice of Cosmo.
Hey, that could be a thing. Suffice it to say,
yeah, but I really don't know. And I think that James Gunn saying important characters is probably overstating it a bit. I think if they were ultra important to the movie, they would probably be main characters. You know, I think this is going to be more of a glorified.
What if they were very, very important characters, like Rorschach?
Then they would be in Watchmen Rorschach.
Well, I'm very much excited about this. And just as important that no one seems to be talking about, this is a Tango and Cash reunion, Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone will both be in the movie, and I hope there's at least one scene where they both wear comically oversized 80s glasses. With that being said, folks, that wraps up the rundown, and with it, another Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. Hope you enjoyed our stroll down memory lane with the X-Men the Animated Series and our look at the week of comics and news and notes and TV shows. One little thing. Last week, we talked about confusion over Deadpool having teleportation powers in Marvel Ultimate Alliance. Well, I looked it up. Deadpool does not have the ability to teleport in the comics. However, he has been known to use teleportation technology, devices that allow him to teleport. Hence why Ultimate Alliance allowed him to teleport. Hence why it was still out of character for him to have the mutant ability to teleport in X-Men Origins Wolverine. So that little mystery, for us anyway, has been solved. Nick, tell the good folks what's coming their way in coming weeks.
Sure. So next week here on the podcast, we're celebrating our landmark 50th episode with a very special giant-sized edition looking back at the first year of DC's rebirth. We will be joined on this episode by Place to Be Nation personalities Todd Weber from Conversation Comics, Jennifer Smith from Geek and Sassy, and Russell Sellers from Sellers Points, in which we'll be discussing pretty much all the ins and outs and what have yous of DC's rebirth initiative, now almost 1 year into the initiative. The week after that, we will be broadcasting live on location, or actually on tape delay on location from Orlando, Florida, as myself, Greg, Todd Weber, Russell Sellers, and Andrew Chandler Fraser Garner all sit in a room together for an edition of Hard Travelers for Hire that we've kind of been building to since we started that little ongoing concept, in that we finally reached Marvel's The Avengers. And really, that will kick off, you know, or I guess really next week, the giant size kicks off a month-long celebration that is really intended to just kind of, you know, look back, Greg, for us, as we're going to be marking not only our 50th episode, but also our one-year anniversary in the month of April. And so all April long, we're going to be doing episodes that we've teased for a long time or talked about for a long time. We're finally going to be getting around to some of them. I know, in particular, off the page, I know we have talked about the idea of forcing me to watch Batman Forever again at some point and talk about all the reasons I hate it and talk about why it's actually the worst Batman movie of all time, even worse than Batman and Robin. So we will be doing that at some point. We've got a big issue of Countdown that I can't remember what the theme of it is. And for long book hunters in the month of April, we will be taking a look at the book that gave our podcast its name. We, the hard traveling fanboys, we'll be taking a look at the Hard Traveling Heroes as we go back to the old Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams classic Green Arrow, Green Lantern run. So lots of big things coming up for you in the month of
Absolutely. April. And until then, let us know what you thought about the show. I already mentioned how you can get in touch with us, but just in case you missed it, Twitter at gphillips8652, at nickduke87, Facebook, look up Place to Be Nation Comics, join the page, join the discussion. Send us emails. GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com. NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. Hope you enjoyed it. And we will wrap things up. Until next time. Have a good one, folks.
X-Men are cool. X-Men rule. They're no fools. X-Men duel.
X-Men
fighting
kick
ghouls. Breaking rules.
First you got the Wolverine. Super Mega Death Machine. Gambit's cards are really keen. Shine like rubies. Cyclops always leads the team, while sometimes making out with Jean. Rogue and Storm are real hotties with big boobies. Jubilee cheerfully fireworks off with glee, and the Beast wants at least quotes the book War and Peace. ESP is the key constantly for Xavier. And there's some other X-Men too, but they don't have a lot to do. Just some cameos for you to view. And there's this evil bad guy who lost his parents cause they're Jews. Magneto's his nom de plume. It's true. All these guys want this guy flying high in the sky. Really try not to die getting by knowing why they are the saviors. Xavier's X-Men kick-ass. X-Men is a kick-ass show. Now you know.